The Cultural and Outdoor Resources Finance Division meeting will come to order Thursday, April 16th, 2009, 2 p.m. First item on the agenda is Representative Paul Torkelson, who is going to give us a presentation about the Clean Water Minnesota, the role of Minnesota's Clean Water Council, of which he is a member and has been since the beginning.
That's correct.
And he will soon be replaced, but not yet. And Representative Torkelson spoke with me, and I said I would like him to address the committee. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have distributed a handout to the committee members, and there are a few extras that are available to the public. As you stated, Madam Chair, I am a member of the Clean Water Council and have been since its inception and the first meeting back in March of 2007. The Clean Water Council was created when the Clean Water Legacy Act passed the legislature in 2006. The council is made up of 23 members, and on the back of the sheet it lists the current members and their terms and what areas they represent. I'm pleased to note that the current chair of the council is Marilyn Bernardson. She took over recently, and she is one of six women who serve on the council. I know the chair is interested in gender diversity in our various councils, and we are happy to have that on ours. The first portion of the handout really is just, I've taken just the clean water language out of the constitutional amendment. It's language we've all seen many times, but just for a point of reference. The Clean Water Council really carries a lot of history with it. The G16, a diverse group of lobbyists that has been working on the clean water issues for a number of years. The Clean Water Legacy Act is really their brainchild, and they, in their wisdom, decided that the Clean Water Council would not include any lobbyists. So none of the G16 members actually serve on the council. It is made up of the folks that you see listed before you. And interestingly, while we did have testimony from the G16 before the Clean Water Council and testimony from a great number of other groups and interests, the G16 has seen our products and does endorse the output of the council. I think that's a good indication that the council has kind of fulfilled their vision for what the Clean Water Council ought to be. The council does bring in a wide variety of groups and does include representatives from the state agencies that are involved, including Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, the Department of Ag, Department of Natural Resources, and the Board of Water and Soil Resources. The missing link there is the Department of Health. If the council does continue to meet, and I'm sure it will, and if we do see in our wisdom to authorize them as an advisory group for the constitutional amendment funds, I would think that adding a seat for the Department of Health would be an appropriate step to take. I serve on the council as a representative of agriculture. There are two ag seats on the council along with the other seats I've described, and while I'm not, I can't say that I agree with every single thing that has come out of that room, I do really feel that the council has done very good work, and in fact, they were wise enough to come and visit my farm, and we had a session there in my garage, and we talked about ag and water, and it was a good day. The Clean Water Council does operate in an open fashion. All our meetings are publicly posted, and the minutes from those meetings are on MPCA's website. MPCA has been the enabling state organization for the council, and they have done a fine job of keeping the council on track and publishing the information produced by the council. One of the first official things the council did was hear testimony from the Public Finance Authority, and we did advise the governor on the structure of the Public Finance Authority 2008 budget. And then the next big piece of official output was communication to the governor's office relating to the governor's budget. And I would remind everyone that all the recommendations that came from the Clean Water Council were incorporated into the governor's budget, and the bills that are currently floating around the state legislature regarding clean water funding all reflect in some, with some minor differences, the Clean Water Council's recommendations. The areas that we endorsed focusing on are the areas where funding is focused, and whatever comes out of the legislature this year will most likely reflect the work of the Clean Water Council. So the work we've done is already coming to fruition and will probably be incorporated into law this year. And the reason I'm bringing this information before you today is because I feel strongly that the Clean Water Council should be given authorization to act in a similar fashion to the LaSard Council as an advisory group to this committee and to the Minnesota State Legislature on how the future funds generated by the constitutional amendment are spent as we go on our 25-year journey through funds generated and hopefully utilized to the best possible fashion as we move ahead. We've all seen the Clean Water Council's report. I don't know if you have yours before you. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but I will just highlight a couple of things. The areas of focus are monitoring assessment, TMDL development, restoration and protection, infrastructure investment, civic engagement, performance measures, which relates, as it states here, to outcome-related performance measures. I just want to make sure I got my outcomes in there for the benefit of one of our members especially, and, of course, focus on research. We have met monthly since 2007, and as I stated earlier, we have had output related to PFA and to the governor's budget. With that, I will not take any more of the committee's precious time. It's a very nice day, and those of us in agriculture would like to be out of here in a timely fashion so that we can go do other work. I'm prepared to take any questions.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Representative Torkelson. If this committee was invited down to your apartment, could we at least come in the house?
No. Yes. Yes. Thank you. I would be happy to have you and any representative from this committee in my house. But the garage gave us a nice—it's a nice garage, by the way—and it gave us adequate space to serve a meal all in one room.
Well, the food's in the garage. Fine.
I thought you might be interested.
The picture of the council at your farm.
Yes.
Is in the.
That is outdoors. Right. That is outdoors, actually, and we are examining my combine in that picture, and I am trying to explain to some folks who have not much idea what happens on a farm just what a combine is for and what it does as it goes through the field.
And I'm sure, Representative Davis, you would be interested in that combine.
The only if it's green, Madam Chair.
And it is.
Absolutely. Any other questions? Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I could probably remember this from the report early in the session. The project says both protect and restore. Was there then an intentional attempt to balance both how much you spent on prevention and how much you spent on cleanup after the fact?
Well, certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair. Certainly, prevention has been an ingredient in our discussions from the beginning, but I would say that the language of the constitutional amendment probably has a stronger emphasis on protection and prevention than did the language from the Clean Water Legacy Act of 2006. The Legacy Act really focused on a TMDL process, and that is more of a process that involves testing, producing a TMDL report, and then implementing cleanup. But I assure you it would be very easy for the council to add more emphasis to prevention and protection area for our waters, and we all feel strongly that that's certainly an appropriate endeavor.
I, Madam Chair, always think that what we have been doing
is trying to mop up after the fact for many years, so that's probably pretty typical. That probably ought to be in our budgets. And if we really say this measure was to supplement that, finally putting some money into prevention might hopefully be one of the outcomes mm-hmm. as well.
And we will have other opportunities to speak to that next week at our meetings. But anything else addressing what Representative Tarkelson presented? I have a question, Representative Tarkelson. Then the PCA is the host agency.
That's correct.
And then the money is funded through the Environment Bill for PCA?
I would assume so.
For the Clean Water Council?
I would assume okay. so. They have made no indication they're going to quit and taking care of us. So.
And do you know what last year's budget was?
No, I do not.
Okay.
I don't know if there's anyone from PCA here today that would be able to outline that for us or not.
We can get that next week, too. But you also said that there was no lobbyist. Specifically, no lobbyist could be appointed to the council.
That is correct. In fact, Madam Chair, I am probably the world's shortest lived lobbyist. As when I was Vice President of Minnesota Farm Bureau, I was asked to get a lobbyist registration number, and I did. And 1 week later, I was asked to get rid of it so I could be on this council. So my lobbying career was extremely brief.
Did you get rid of it? No, Representative Tarkelson, can lobbyists lobby the council?
Anybody can talk to us, and it's an open forum, basically. And we did have the G16, some of the leaders of the G16 come in and present to us early on because we wanted to know what their vision was. And so we've been in contact with them, but I would say they have not been, certainly have not been present at more than a handful of our meetings and have not a direct role in the output of the council.
And can you refresh us, some of us that weren't so actively involved in the Clean Water Legacy Act, why when the Clean Water Legacy Act suggested forming the council, why legislators were not placed on it? I realize you weren't here then, so you don't know.
You're above my pay grade.
Okay.
But I would add my personal perspective on that. I actually think that's a good idea, and I have found my role on the council has changed dramatically since I've been elected to office. Number one, I don't have enough time to attend all the meetings. I try to get there for an hour and a half, and then I'm called to other duties, as my legislative duties. And my point of view is different as a legislator. You become much more parochial when you are a legislator. I mean, you kind of worry a little bit more about your district or your constituents than I did as a statewide Farm Bureau Vice President. I had a broader perspective, I think. I mean, I'm still the same person, but it does change. And I personally, and this goes against most of my colleagues' thoughts, I personally think it's fine that we don't have legislators on these committees. I think if I were to make a suggestion, I would suggest that we have subcommittees of this committee in each of the four areas that would interact with the councils, with the LSARD and the Clean Water and whatever we end up with for the other areas, and take a special interest in certain areas, but I think these groups need to do their own thing. I may change my mind on that after a couple more years in the legislature. I don't know.
No, that perspective is very good. And what you just said is very interesting. You said, I heard right, that you would have subcommittees, you would suggest that there be subcommittees of this committee
mm-hmm.
that monitor each of the four funds that we have to responsibility of distributing.
And I guess this is just my vision, of course, but I would envision those legislators as being welcome at any meetings that the Clean Water Council, for instance, would have. They would be invited if they could come any time, sit in for as long as they had time for, observe what's going on, communicate to the committee what the legislature is up to and what the legislature is thinking about, but not have a voting seat and not be expected to attend every meeting for its full duration, which is... I did briefly observe the Lessard Council, and I know that the legislators on the council had a difficult time attending all the meetings all the time. It's just this schedule that we operate on is a strenuous one, and it requires our attention to be divided in many different pieces of the pie.
Thank you. And representatives, where are these council meetings held?
We've generally met at the Department of Agriculture in their meeting rooms, although we've also met in the judicial building next door to the Capitol, and of course on my farm.
Thank you.
In the garage.
Right. In the garage, yes. With the food.
Very good. Well, let us give this suggestion some thought, and thank you for that update, and thank you for sharing your thoughts with us.
I would like to thank the chair for allowing me to have some time before this committee. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Davis.
I'd like to move the minutes to Wednesday, April 15th, 2009.
Representative Davis moves adoption of the minutes of the previous meeting be adopted as printed. Any additions or corrections? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are adopted. Thank you. Representative Torkelson, in his presentation, just gave us an idea for the committee. Many people that have come to this meeting, come to our meeting since January, have given us ideas for the four funds. We will continue to accept those ideas. If anyone has additional ideas that haven't been presented before, you can present them in writing up to Tuesday morning. You can present them to me tomorrow, Monday, and if you see me first thing Tuesday morning, but if we go beyond Tuesday morning, I'll say, oh, I can't accept your piece of paper. So if there's any ideas that haven't been presented that somebody's been holding back, jot them down and get them in if you want any consideration. They've already been given to our many, many meetings, to our many, many emails, to our many, many letters, to our various conversations. You don't have to repeat. But if there's still something to be said, Tuesday morning, going to be it. Second item on the agenda today is Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. I just have a question on what you're envisioning for the process, the progress of the bill. Are you looking at... We have several different... bills out there, I think Representative Eakin has one, Representative Lilly, dealing with various components of the amendment. Are you looking at doing them individually, or are we putting them all together? What are you thinking?
I'm looking at we're going to do some of them individually and some of them together. I'm looking at meetings every day next week, possibly, either in committee or in caucuses. I'm looking at having a final product on the 30th of the month, and I'm looking at having a couple different drafts out sometime next week for us to react to. But today is the first run-through of the Outdoor Heritage specific recommendations, and I expect that we will be speaking about the recommendations on another date early next week or middle of next week, and there will be the opportunity at that time perhaps for if there are suggested amendments that come in, and then we will incorporate that into the final bill, and there will be another opportunity after that. I expect to do clean water, the Clean Water Fund recommendations next week, and Representative Wiginius's bill will also be coming before us. And then there's going to be a couple of different drafts, at least from what has already been suggested and thrown out and thrown in, and for the arts and heritage and culture and museums and civics and who knows all those other things, and they are evolving, and they are going to be kind of put together. But we will be talking a lot about them also.
So
it's going to come together.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you do envision the possibility of all of this being into one bill?
Yes, I do. And I was told today again that we're going forward with the one bill.
Okay, thank you.
Now, that's subject to change, but that's what I was told as of 1 o'clock today. So, and all four funds will be included in the one bill. I do have to tell you, as long as you're asking, surgery started on House File 2229, our omnibus finance bill for our agencies. And last night, when the environment bill was presented in finance, I moved to the Minnesota Zoo and the Science Museum into Representative Wiginius's environment bill. K-12 is going tomorrow, is going to be up tomorrow in finance, and I will move that libraries and museums go into the K-12 bill. State government, is that tomorrow?
Yeah.
That's tomorrow too. And I will move that amateur sports, Black Minnesotans Council, Chicano, Latin Affairs Council, Asian Pacific Minnesota Council, and the Indian Affairs Council recommendations will go into that bill. And the economic development bill, PFA, the Explore Minnesota Tourism, Historical Society, Arts Board, Humanities Center, Public Broadcasting will go into that bill. And then they'll all match up. Questions? Okay. All right. The next item on the agenda, the Outdoor Heritage Council recommendations. Mr. Kilgore, Mr. Beggar, welcome back.
Thank you.
I promised that you would be able to come back and help present the specific recommendations. And Representative Hansen, you have those specific recommendations in House File 2131.
Yes, thank
welcome.
You.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I also want to acknowledge other members of the council that are here, former Representative Darby Nelson, Jim Cox, who is the Vice Chair of the Council, and Representative Gump. And we do not have a quorum, so I just wanted to make sure that we're
A quorum of your
of the council.
Council. Yes. Very good. Welcome back, Mr. Nelson, Mr. Cox, and Mr. Representative Gunther.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have in front of you House File 2131. This is the product of the Lessard Outdoor Heritage Council and a wide variety of folks who've worked very long hours and a lot of time in putting this together. Mr. Kilgore went through the information earlier in front of this committee, so I think we'll just dive right into the recommendations here and the appropriations. And just to note, the first page, we are primarily appropriating money for the first year here. I mean, this is somewhat of a one-year appropriation. The council has the charge to come back and make recommendations by the end of this year for next year. That's in general, there are some appropriations in here that are for multiple years and for that recognize other commitments.
And you'll point those out.
And I will point those out. And we can make available for the committee the last forecast estimated about over $77 million being available in the sales tax revenue that would start being collected on July 1st of this year. We are appropriating only $69.522 million of that. So we are holding a reserve of roughly 10% based on the February forecast and are appropriating that amount. So as we go through this, and that's on the front page, we're at about $69.5 million in terms of appropriations of the sales tax revenue that will be coming in. The first, we break the bill into various segments that are in the Constitution, and so I'll be starting with prairies. And but before I do that, I would just offer to Mr. Kilgore or Mr. Becker to any comments that they may have before we start diving in.
We're ready to dive
in. Okay.
Excuse me, I think another member has come in. It's Senator
Ingebrigtsen. I recognize Senator Ingebrigtsen. Prairies on Subdivision 2. The first project is Accelerated Prairie and Grassland Management, $1.7 million. The outcome of this is to restore 2,000 acres, enhance 5,350 acres. It will include initial development of land acquired under the Prairie Grassland Wildlife Management Area acquisition. The location will be in the Northern Prairie Parklands, Red River Valley Prairie, the deciduous transition, Minnesota River Prairie, Southeast Bluffland ecological sections. And I'm going to have the our pages hand out these sections, a map of the sections as we go through. The manager of this component is the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. The Green Corridor Legacy Program is $1.617 million to the Commissioner of Natural Resources for an agreement with the Southwest Initiative Foundation to acquire land in Redwood County to be added to the state outdoor recreation system. This will protect 580 acres of prairie. Its location is in Redwood County, the Minnesota River Prairie, and land acquired will be transferred to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service or the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. And I'm going to talk a little bit in each of these projects where we have state acquisition about payment in lieu of taxes and the PILT liability for the project. I've handed out in your packets a recent Attorney General's opinion relating to payment in lieu of taxes. The maximum state PILT liability for this project will be $12,000 yearly. Is that correct, Mr. Beck?
That's correct.
The next is the Prairie Heritage Fund Acquisition and Restoration. This is a grant to the Commissioner through the Commissioner of Natural Resources for an agreement with Pheasants Forever to acquire and restore land to be added to the state wildlife management area system. It will protect through fee simple acquisition 1,100 acres of grasslands and restore 1,400 acres of grassland habitat. The location will be primarily in the Minnesota River Prairie and the deciduous transition ecological areas of the state. The manager will be Pheasants Forever. The land will be transferred to the DNR. The PILT liability will be approximately $18,000 yearly. Next will be the Accelerated Prairie Grassland Wildlife Management Area Acquisition. This is to the Commissioner of Natural Resources to acquire land for wildlife management areas with native prairie or grassland habitat. This will protect 640 acres of prairie and 1,600 acres of wetlands. The price, $3.913 million. And I should note, I did not say that the acquisition and the restoration above was $3 million for the acquisition and restoration area. This particular is a grant to DNR. So DNR does the acquisition. 640 acres of prairie, 160 acres of wetlands. This will be in the prairie, deciduous transition, and southeast bluffland ecological section. The manager being the DNR. The silt liability will be approximately $28,000 yearly. The next is the Northern Tallgrass Prairie National Wildlife Refuge Protection. This is $1.583 million. And this one's a little different. This grant goes to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to acquire land or permanent easements within the Northern Tallgrass Prairie Habitat Preservation Area in western Minnesota. This will protect 525 acres of tallgrass prairie. It will protect 1,583 acres through easement or a combination of the above. The locations will be the Minnesota River Prairie, the Red River Valley Prairie, and the Northern Parklands Prairie ecological sections. Key counties in this will be Wilkin, Polk, Rock, and Clay. Wilkin, Polk, Rock, and Clay. And the manager is the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The difference with the federal one is that the federal agency picks up the payment in lieu of taxes, so there's not a PILT obligation here for the state. And I want to note that we have a number of the managers of these projects available with us today. If you have specific questions on the projects, we can go through those after I do the run through. We have some people here who can speak on that.
What do you mean by manager of the project?
The Madam Chair, the proposer, for example, I don't know on this one if U.S. Fish and Wildlife is here, but I believe we have one coming up that is a Trout Unlimited one, and I see there's some folks from Trout Unlimited here. So there are folks who would be receiving the dollars ultimately that could talk about the project and how they'll manage that.
Thank you.
Bluffland Prairie Protection Initiative, $500,000 for the Commissioner of Natural Resources for an agreement with the Minnesota Land Trust to acquire permanent easements protecting critical prairie and grassland habitats in the Blufflands of southeastern Minnesota. This will protect 300 to 500 acres of Bluffland Prairie using conservation easements. Location, southeast Blufflands ecological section, specifically Fillmore, Goodhue, Houston, Olmsted, Wabasha, and Winona counties. Representative Manager, Minnesota Land Trust, and the costs for the stewardship are included in this acquisition. This is an easement acquisition, so it does not have a PILT consequence. Rum River Cedar Creek Initiative, $1.9 million is to the Commissioner of Natural Resources for an agreement with Anoka County to acquire land at the confluence of the Rum River and Cedar Creek in Anoka County. This will protect 150 acres of wetlands, 250 acres of prairie, 150 acres of forest. This is deciduous transition ecological area, specifically Anoka County. The manager is Anoka County. This, earlier I'd mentioned we have a couple projects that have obligations in the second year. This is one of those. So this is providing half of the acquisition costs up front. And we would be anticipating in the second year to be having the second half of the acquisition. I believe Anoka County is here. Yes. Okay. So there is someone here from Anoka County if we had questions about that. Another thing that's different with this particular project, this would include some parkland, and so the constitutional amendment says that land purchased through fee acquisition must be open to hunting and fishing during the open season unless otherwise provided for by law. And so we are providing in law here, you'll see language that acquired land must remain open to hunting and fishing, consistent with the capacity of the land, during the open season as determined by the Commissioner of Natural Resources. So you'll see that in the rider language. Next we go to forests. And I think members of the committee have their constitutional language in their packets, so they can look for that.
Representative Erdahl?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Was there a PILT payment on the last one?
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl?
Hansen.
No, there was not. That's a metro county and does not have a PILT consequence. The next is $20 million for the Forest for the Future program. This is for the commission to the Commission of Natural Resources to acquire land or permanent working forest easements on private forests in areas identified through the State Forest for the Future program. This would protect, and this is the first year payment. We are the total cost is greater than this. We're looking at a second year. I believe that DNR has finalized the price, and so this would protect 187,277 acres of forest, or protect 187,277 acres. 127,277 of that are forests, and 60,000 are wetlands with permanent conservation easements, and 1,344 acres of forest with fee title ownership. This includes 280 miles of stream and lakeshore. The location is in the Arrowhead, Peatlands, and Northern Lakes ecological sections, specifically the counties of Itasca, St. Louis, Aiken, Coochiching, Beltrami, Cass, and Clearwater. The manager is the Department of Natural Resources, and this is approximately half of the funds needed to complete this. That's the primary wetlands or primary forest proposal in the bill. Next, we move to wetlands. Accelerated Wildlife Management Area acquisition, $2.9 million to the Commissioner of Natural Resources to acquire land for wildlife management areas, or WMAs. We can start probably using the acronym to WMAs. This would protect 140 acres of wetland and 500 acres of prairie. This location would be the deciduous transition of Minnesota River Prairie ecological section, specifically Dakota, Wright, Nicollet, Faribault, Isanti, Anoka, Washington, Murray, and Swift counties.
Okay. So would you give me the number of acres for wetlands again?
140 acres of wetlands and 560 acres of prairie. And generally when we have wetland acquisitions, you also are looking at the associated uplands that go into that wetland complex. That's why you have the additional acres of prairie that are involved with the wetlands. The DNR is the manager. The state PILT liability would be $21,000 a year. Accelerated shallow lake restorations and enhancements. $2.528 million. This is for a grant through the Commissioner of Natural Resources in agreement with Ducks Unlimited to restore and enhance shallow lake habitat. This will protect 180 acres of shallow lake habitat with permanent easements. It will enhance 6,000 acres of shallow lake habitat in 8 shallow lakes. The location will be the deciduous transition in Minnesota River Prairie Ecological System, specifically Stearns, Douglas, Grant, Lac La Parle, Yellow Medicine, Murray, Wright, and Faribault counties. The manager is Ducks Unlimited, and this does include Lake Christina and engineering for 2 additional projects. Accelerated Waterfowl Production Area Program. This is $5.6 million to the Commissioner of Natural Resources for an agreement with Pheasants Forever to acquire and restore wetland and related upland habitats in cooperation with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Ducks Unlimited to be managed as waterfowl production areas. This will protect and restore 400 acres of wetland and I believe that's 800 acres of grassland. Chair Kilgore's eyes are better than mine, but counties are within the Prairie Pothole Joint Venture of the Minnesota. and the Wright County Deciduous Transition, Minnesota River Prairie, Red River Valley Ecological Section. The manager is Pheasants Forever. The cooperators are the U.S. Fish and Wildlife and Ducks Unlimited. The federal government will pay PILT, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife will also pay for the restoration and enhancement. So this is an example of a collaborative on-the-ground project. The next is a program that I think members of the committee are familiar with, and particularly Representative Hausman. This is the Reinvest in Minnesota Wetland Reserve Program Acquisition, $9,058,000 to acquire permanent easements and restore wetlands and associated uplands in cooperation with the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Wetland Reserve Program. This will restore 4,100 acres of prairie and native grasslands and 1,700 acres of drained wetlands comprising 290 wetland basins. This is a statewide program. The manager is the Board of Water and Soil Resources. The cooperator is the USDA Natural Resource Conservation Service and Soil and Water Conservation District. This will leverage $12,681,000 in federal money. So we've heard in the bonding committee, and we have a proposal in the bonding proposal that passed the House, for every dollar that we spend in Reinvest in Minnesota through this program, we get $1.4 back. And we also have a job creation leveraging that occurs. I think it's about $1.57 for every dollar that we spend here, because we are hiring local contractors to restore that wetland, hiring local feed, involving people in those restorations. So the bang for the buck on this is very high. Shallow Lake Critical Shoreland, $450,000 in fiscal year 2010 is the Commission on Natural Resources, again for an agreement with Ducks Unlimited to protect habitat by acquiring land associated with shallow lakes. This will restore 50 acres of shoreline-oriented grassland. It will protect 90 acres of shoreline-oriented uplands and 10 acres of wetland associated with critical wetlands. This is in the Minnesota River Prairie Ecological Section, Murray County. The manager is Ducks Unlimited. It will eventually be transferred to public managers such as U.S. Fish and Wildlife or DNR. The state maximum silt liability will be $3,200 yearly. Next, we move into the next clause of the Constitution, Fish, Game, and Wildlife Habitat. The Outdoor Heritage Conservation Partners Grant Program is a $4 million for fiscal year 2010 to the Commissioner of Natural Resources to provide competitive matching grants up to $400,000 to local, regional, state, national organizations, including government for enhancement, restoration, protection of forests, wetlands, prairies, and habitat for fish, game, and wildlife in Minnesota. This provision was changed in Representative Kahn's committee. Originally, this was to the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, and it was amended in the previous committee to be the Commissioner of Natural Resources. There's some language here. It will provide an estimated 75 to 150 grants for restoration, protection, and enhancement of wetlands, be done through local and fish and game clubs, other habitat-oriented private groups and municipal government, statewide, and one of the criteria is that the restoration and enhancement work done will be on permanently protected land. You'll see some more detail through this, that the commissioner land acquired and fee must be open to hunting and fishing during the open season, again using that constitutional language. The program shall require a match of at least $1 in non-state funds to $10 in state funds. Non-state dollars match may be in kind. The criteria for evaluating grant applications must include the amount of habitat restored, enhanced, and protected. And you'll see on page 8 there's a lot of definition and protection in terms of the prairie restoration and the amount, how those dollars are flowing through the small grant program. Next is the Aquatic Management Area Acquisition. $5.748 million to the Commissioner of Natural Resources to acquire land and fee title and easement to be added to the state aquatic management area system. This will protect 12 miles of stream shoreline and 1,300 acres of adjoining habitat on the land. As statewide application, the manager will be the Department of Natural Resources, and it has 22,000 for restoration and enhancement. The state tilt liability is approximately 41,000 a year. Cold River Stream, Cold Water River and Stream Restoration Protection and Enhancement, $2,050,000 to the Commissioner of Natural Resources for an agreement with Trout Unlimited to restore, enhance, and protect cold water river and stream habitats in Minnesota. This is going to restore 14.3 miles of stream, enhance 1 mile of in-stream habitat, enhance 90 acres of onshore habitat. Specifically, it will be dealing with Hay Creek in Goodhue County, Cabacoma Creek in Hubbard County, Lawndale Creek in Wilkin County, Little Rock Creek in Benton County, the Whitewater River in Olmsted County, Mill Creek in Fillmore County, Trout Run Creek in Fillmore County, Straight River in Becker and Hubbard, Sucker River in St. Louis, and the Vermilion River in Dakota. The Dakota County Habitat Protection Program, $1 million in fiscal year 2010, is the Commissioner of Natural Resources for an agreement with Dakota County for the acquisition of permanent easements. This will protect 350,000 acres of oak forest, associated wetlands, including 3.25 miles of shoreline. This is in the deciduous transition ecological section, specifically Dakota County. And this, Madam Chair and members, this will be working with some of the referendum money that was passed in Dakota County in 2002 to protect farmland and natural areas. So it's going to be matching some level, some additional local money. And I see the manager of that program is here if you have any questions on that. Lake Rebecca Water Quality Improvement Project, $450,000 to the Commission of Natural Resources for an agreement with the Three Rivers Park District to improve water quality in Lake Rebecca in the Lake Rebecca Park Reserve in Hennepin County. This will be the restoration of one shallow lake. It's in the deciduous transition ecological section, specifically Hennepin County. It's the Three Rivers Park District that will be the manager. And Lake Rebecca is a top-quality musky lake in Minnesota. In Fountain Lake, in Representative Brown's area, there is fish barriers. $655,000 for the Commissioner of Natural Resources for an agreement with the Shell Rock River Watershed District to construct fish barriers at three locations in Fountain Lake. Land acquisition necessary for fish barrier construction is permitted. This will restore three shallow lakes, specifically the transition ecological section in Freeborn County, and the manager is the Shell Rock River Watershed District. Those are the projects, Madam Chair and members of the committee. We now move into some of the administration. Contract management, $175,000 this fiscal year to the Commissioner of Natural Resources for contract management in fiscal years 2010 and 2011. This is for the DNR for the execution of the agreements and project oversight.
And this is a DNR contract with someone else?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is for the administration, for example, when there is the contract Two Pheasants Forever or Ducks Unlimited, the costs involved with that. Mr. Becker could maybe detail them.
Mr. Becker?
Yes. The job of the Department of Natural Resources is to negotiate and put in place a legal binding agreement that implements the legislative appropriation, to oversee that agreement, and to reimburse the recipients based on their expenses direct to the project.
Continue on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Next is $695,000 to the Legislative Coordinating Commission for administrative expenses of the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council and for compensation and expense reimbursement of council members. Specifically, that is for the administration of the council, for three staff, face equipment programming, meetings, and loan repayment. estimated cost, executive director, $130,000, administrative assistant, $80,000, program research analyst, $120,000, public meeting facility facilitation contract, $60,000, office rent, phones, computers, systems, $50,000, travel meeting expenses, estimated 20 meetings, $80,000, and then repayment of the DNR for the FY 2009 loan, $150,000. We've heard that. That was my bill, House File 18, that is still sitting, I think, on the register. Now a Senate file. And then $25,000 in the reserve adds up to $695,000.
Continue on.
The availability of the appropriations. Unless otherwise provided, the amounts in this section are available until June 30th, 2011, when projects must be completed and final accomplishments reported. The money is available unless money for the real property acquisition, in which case the funds are available for one additional year. This particularly relates to if a project receives federal funding. There's additional time to close the deal on those federal funds. Cash advances, and this is something the council spent some time on, looking at the challenges we have with the dollars coming in over a period of time. This allows borrowing from the general fund. If the Outdoor Heritage Fund borrows one day a month, it pays interest to the general fund for the month at a rate of 1.17% of the average daily balance for the month. The cash flow analysis indicates the maximum borrowed would be less than $1 million. Through that borrowing, the Outdoor Heritage Fund would lose about $50,000 in interest to the general fund. Again, here we're looking at acquisition opportunities, and the dollars may not be available as the receipts come in for those acquisition opportunities. Accomplishment plan requires plans, delineates the outcome the state attains for, provides a schedule for administration by the DNR, accounts for the use of funds appropriated, and includes an evaluation by the recipient of the outcome received, and it provides for approval by the council. I want to point out on 12.13, none of the money provided in this section may be expended unless the council has an approved pertinent accomplishment plan. Project requirements. These have basic principles of the Outdoor Heritage Council. Using native plant materials, all easements are permanent. Using scientific principles, full funding of projects, transparency, confining state expenditures to restoration enhancement only to permanently protected property, and it encourages the use of the Minnesota Conservation Corps for restoration and enhancement work. You see some of the details in that. Restoration, preparing an ecological and restoration management plan. To ensure public accountability, the use of public funds provides to the Outdoor Heritage Council documentation of the selection process used to identify the parcels acquired and provide documentation of all related transaction costs, including but not limited to appraisals, legal fees, recording fees, commissions, and other similar costs and donations. The recipient may also report to the council any difference between the acquisition amount paid to the seller and the state-certified, state-reviewed appraisal. Acquisition data such as appraisals may remain private during negotiations but must ultimately be made public according to Minnesota Statute Chapter 14. Next on Subdivision 11 is payment conditions and capital equipment expenditures. Reimbursements may be delayed until the cash flow is available. Reimbursements for expenditures directly related to the appropriation purpose. Payment is contingent on demonstration of the outcomes achieved and progress made toward outcomes. And the advances are permitted with an approval of the accomplishment plan. We do have a couple of projects, I think, with the federal government that we have to be a little different in terms of how we distribute the money. Some kind of basic language here on purchase of recycled products and recyclable materials. accessibility with the Americans with Disabilities Act, land acquisitions, some restrictions that land will not be converted to non-habitat uses, allows for exceptions with approval of the state, replacement of land at converted land with the land of the same habitat values, requires filing of notice with of restrictions with the real property deed. So there's some details on that relating to appraisals, fair market value, etc. Requires a real property interest report. By December 1st of each year, a recipient of money appropriated under this section that is used in acquisition of an interest in property, including but not limited to easements or fee title, must submit an annual report on the status of the real property to the council or its successor on a form determined by the council.
Excuse me, Representative Howes has a question.
Well, Madam Chair, I'll wait till it's done. I just want to make sure I'd be first in line.
Okay.
First second.
You'll be first.
Thanks.
There's some language here that was added in Representative Kahn's committee report. Requiring reports to the council by recipients must also go to the Commissioner of Finance. And the Commissioner must maintain a website with a searchable database providing the public with information on the expenditures. And to the extent practical, the Commissioner must use systems developed to track the expenditure of federal money under the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. So it's kind of taking the federal stimulus procedures and using those at the state level as well. And with that, Madam Chair and members, I believe that is the bill.
Representative
Powell. Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen, I just have a couple questions. One to clear something up. With the Northern Tallgrass Prairie National Grasslands, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Page.
Oh, I'm sorry. It starts on page, bottom of page 3. That money that we give to the Fish and Wildlife Service to acquire land, are we giving them the money that for them to acquire land, or are we giving them money to acquire land for us? And in the end, who holds the fee title to said land?
Representative Hansen.
I'm sure, Representative Howes. We are giving them money to acquire the land, and it will be in the federal system.
Madam
Chair, both fee and easement.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, are they going to give us back some of the boundary waters while we're doing this? Madam Chair, with all due respect, that doesn't sound right. I'm sure the council did a good job, but that does not sound right. Why should we let the United States own any more of Minnesota? And giving them the money to do it.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if we have anyone from U.S. Fish and Wildlife here, but...
Representative
Hodge. Thank you. In that process, if in fact we're giving state money and the ownership goes to the federal government, how do we know that it will always be used for what we want it to be used for? And if it's not, I want it back. Thank you.
That was more of a comment than an answer, Representative.
Well,
but Representative Haas welcomes your comment.
I found that Representative Haas is very intelligent. Even when they mispronounce the name and say Haas.
Is there someone that will attempt to answer?
Madam Chair, if you and Representative Haas and Haas would look on Subdivision 14, on page 16, starting on 16.6, you'll see some of the efforts we have made to try to protect our interests.
Would you explain it a little more so that we don't have to pick it up from our quick read?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Becker.
Subdivision 14 basically says that if you convert the land to a different use, you have to replace it. It does allow for conversion with approval of the state, but it has to be replaced at face value. So that, otherwise, the land is kept in the purpose for which the original appropriation was made.
But Representative Howes.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, we're talking about the United States government. They could have a executive order, they could, an act of Congress, change the intent of that land and not discuss it with us at all. And it could be a lot like Fort Snelling. There are still people here that believe that the Department of Natural Resources owns Fort Snelling, some of that property out there, and they don't. We manage it for the federal government. And this is even worse than that because we're giving them the money to buy it. And I guess my next question is, who are they buying it from?
Madam Chair?
Mr. Becker.
Representative Howes. It's willing sellers.
That wouldn't be the state of Minnesota at some point, would it? I mean...
No, sir.
Representative Davis, to that point.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, if this is a good project, which I'm sure it is, why wouldn't we keep it under the supervision of the Department of Natural Resources of the state of Minnesota?
Madam Chair and Representative Davis, with this particular project, we have the opportunity to put land into that refuge system. We would be having the federal government being responsible for the operations and maintenance of that property. And we would not have the PILT consequence because they would be picking up the payment in lieu of taxes responsibility. So you have the federal system. We are adding to that with purchase from private landowners who are willing to sell.
Representative Hansen, please, will you go back to line 3.33 in your notes, and would you repeat for us what you said under that section? Maybe if we hear it one more time, it'll sound different.
I'll read the language, and then I'll also read what this will accomplish.
Yep.
So the outcome.
That's what I meant.
So $1.583 million in fiscal year 2010 to the Commissioner of Natural Resources. It goes through the DNR, to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, to acquire land or permanent easements within the northern Tallgrass Prairie Habitat Preservation Area in western Minnesota. The Commissioner may advance funds to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and a list of proposed fee title and permanent easement acquisitions must be provided as part of the required accomplishment plan. What will this do? It will protect 1,100 acres of grasslands and restore about 1,400 acres of grassland habitat. Oops, I'm in the wrong one here. Excuse me, Madam Chair. This will protect 525 acres of tallgrass prairie through easement or fee, 1,583 acres through easement. These are the key counties are Wilkin, Polk, Rock, and Clay. And the ecosystems are the Minnesota River Prairie, Red River Valley Prairie, and Northern Parklands Prairie. I apologize, I read the Pheasants Forever portion.
Okay, 520 grasslands and restore what? How many acres?
1,583 acres will be protected through easement. It's a combination of restoration and acquisition. And we do have the actual, for each of these projects, we have the proposals as they were presented to the council and we vote on. So if members would like copies of those, we can provide those to the members.
I bet Representative Howes does.
Madam Chair.
The manager here?
We have looked, I believe, U.S. Fish and Wildlife is not here.
Oh.
And I'm not sure if anyone from DNR.
I have a suggestion, Madam Chair.
I will take it.
Well, no, you'll hear it. You might not take it. Because if you'll take it, I have a whole list.
Well, that you're going to suggest that we have further information.
I would suggest that we ask some of the real smart attorneys that we have working here at the house and see if we can't craft this in a way that we give the United States government an easement when they purchase this. They have the easement, but some sort of language that says the state of Minnesota still owns the title to this land. So it'd be like a snowmobile easement across somebody's property. DNR has that easement, but the people still own the property. And that's what I think we should have the smart people do for us, because otherwise I would really have to strongly oppose this section of the bill the way it's written. That would be my suggestion.
Madam Chair.
I bet before we take amendments that we will have this language, Representative Hogg.
Yep.
Representative Hogg?
Well, Madam Chair, I had two questions.
Go ahead.
He wanted to respond to you.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you. To that point, Madam Chair and committee members, I've been involved in these land disputes where with the state and with the federal government, and you better hang on to your deed, because you're going to end up somewhere along the line and somewhere in the future, it's going to switch on you, and you don't have control of it anymore. So I think you need to, if in fact they want to use it, that's great, and they want to have a lease into the future, that's great, but you ought to have the deed. And if you don't, I think somewhere along the line in somebody's lifetime, you're going to be sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Howard, you may continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My other question was on page 4 of the Rum River Cedar Creek Initiative, and you mentioned in that paragraph, you read, acquired land must remain open to hunting and fishing, consistent with the capacity, et cetera, et cetera. You explained that land that's acquired through this whole process be remained open, not just for hunting, but public use, as it were. It puzzles me that it's only in that paragraph under the Rum River Cedar Creek Initiative, but not in any other places. That makes me nervous that it's okay here, but in the other places, it's not open to the public. Follow my line of thinking? Am I wrong there?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, Representative Howes, the reason it's not in each of those other ones is because it's assumed that this one is the outlier. This is the one that's unique because they're the conditions, you have that as determined by the Commissioner of Natural Resources. Because this is in the metro area and in the areas that are, there are buffer areas in here with the parkland, so there are some differences in how this land would be managed because it's parkland. So the reason that it's put explicitly in here is because we have the rider to meet the clause in the Constitution that says as otherwise required by law. If you look at your buff colored sheets, it has near the end of the Constitution, it has the language about the fee title acquisition. This is providing the statutory explanation on why this is different. The Constitution overrides on each of the other fee title things that have to be open.
Mr. Becker.
Madam Chair, to add on to that, each of the other acquisitions, or most of them, are going into the wildlife management area system, which is open for hunting. This happens to be the language that the Commissioner of Natural Resources has in terms of managing wildlife management areas. This is exactly the identical language that's used in the wildlife management area statute.
Representative
House,
is that?
Yes, it does, Madam Chair. Thank you very much.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. By the way, to follow up on Representative House's point, you remember, Madam Chair, how hard we had to work for the libraries when we gave them a little bit of state money. We were never going to let our state interest in that.
That's right.
We had to work really hard to figure out after the life of the bond. So anyway, I have just a sort of a flow of a question throughout, and maybe first I should ask, are Pheasants Forever, Ducks Unlimited, and Trout Unlimited on the Outdoor Heritage Council?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, Representative Hausman, and this may be a good opportunity to follow up on Representative Torkelson's comment earlier about the Clean Water Council. When we passed the Clean Water Council and when we passed the Outdoor Heritage Council, we had a prohibition of lobbyists being on these councils. It's written into statute. And so there is not any lobbyist.
So are you saying Pheasants Forever, Ducks Unlimited, and Cal Unlimited are lobbyists?
No, I'm saying that there is nobody representing them, to my knowledge, being paid or that is representing Ducks Unlimited on the council, that they are an employee or a lobbyist.
Or member.
Or I believe that the conflict of interest language that is included with the council is that you can be a member of a general organization, but not having that responsibility of, say, being a president of a chapter or something like that. And we can provide that exact language of which bill, if you've got that language. But there may be members of the council that are members of various
not
organizations.
Not as appointed when different interests right. were appointed to the council.
Right.
And when it says an agreement with, that means money flows to them?
Correct.
That's what that means. So I see on page 3, Pheasants Forever, and on 5, Ducks Unlimited, and on 6, Pheasants Forever and Ducks Unlimited, and 7, Ducks Unlimited, and then some national organization that is not named, and then Trout Unlimited on page 9. And then it appears, and so money would flow to them. Then it appears that in the last pages, the oversight of those functions after the money flows to them is going to be, I see on page 16 that they can't do this without prior review and approval of the Outdoor Heritage Council. On 18, they must submit annual reports on the status of property to the Outdoor Heritage Council. And before an entity receives transfer of property, must certify. So it is the Outdoor Heritage Council is provides the ongoing oversight of these tax dollars. Is that right?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair and Representative Hausman, I think you've pointed out on the pages where that responsibility is. But as this bill is on page 16, you have a prior review and approval of the Outdoor Heritage Council. Also on page 18.232425, the Outdoor Heritage Council. On pages 17.23, 17.24, 17.25, yes. But I want to back up in terms of, you know, we've had, I think, in this committee presentations by the Office of Grants Administration. And so the grant dollars are flowing through the Commission of Natural Resources to the nonprofit rather than directly going to the nonprofit.
And that, Madam Chair, I get, but then with those last pages, it looks like the oversight function is fulfilled by the Outdoor Heritage Council. I guess my confusion, and maybe I missed something, I don't serve on any of those committees, and I don't know why the council was formed or anything, but normally when we have decisions regarding tax dollars and then we have oversight of those agencies that administer the tax dollars, that oversight is done by who hopefully are answerable to the people who elect them. Do we give up oversight function of these particular tax dollars for some reason?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, Representative Hausman, ultimately the legislature has the appropriation authority. This model is the LCCMR model, where the LCCMR, I believe, Mr. Becker, this is some boilerplate language that's similar to the LCCMR.
And I don't know that language, so we never say LCCMR is accountable back to either the governor or the legislature. You know, do we ever close that loop?
Madam Chair, Representative Hubbard, I do not serve on the LCCMR, but my understanding is it's very similar language. Mr. Becker may be able to.
Madam Chair, Representative Hoffman, the LCCMR and the LOHC are part of the legislature. So they are responsible to the body as a whole.
So I guess what I'm trying to figure out, Madam Chair, you know, one of our goals was not to set up new bureaucracy, because bureaucracy costs money. And we didn't, we wanted this money that taxpayers, through their hard-earned dollars, were providing to do more for the outdoors. And so our determination was not to set up new bureaucracy. And I mean, that would be the one thing, as I, and maybe I'm just missing something, but as I'm looking through this bill, that's the concern I have, particularly because now we're putting dollars to that bureaucracy. That if we have state agencies with offices and phones and staff and so forth, we really are setting up a duplicate bureaucracy with what was supposed to be, hopefully, new money. And here's what it feels a little like in another hat I wear, and that is public mass transit. We had the Met Council, and then we created this new thing, CTIB, and the one still has the responsibility, but we raised the tax, and that flows to this other one, and you end up with what some people have called a balkanized mess, because you have multiple bureaucracies sort of responsible for the same thing, but no one has quite enough money. It's not like we're giving more money to do more of something, but we spread it through more. So I'm just missing something in terms of what I thought our goals were relative to not setting up new structures, but at any rate, that's, maybe I'll understand it more as we go along here.
Or not. I think we should make note of that, though, because I think we should go back to our notes of the previous meetings and compare what we just heard. To that point?
Well, on the whole kind of overall administration of the money, that's kind of broadly, it seemed like those were the questions that Alice was asking. And if I ask a question you guys have covered, I was at the tax committee, so just skip it. But I'll just listen to the tape.
Okay.
But the question I had was one of our values on financing, and I think that's what Alice was raising, was that we would give priority to projects that had brought in outside money, or that we'd want to at least acknowledge that. I don't remember exactly how we worded that. And I just, it wasn't clear to me if most of these have outside funding that's a match requirement that's coming in from elsewhere or not, or how that administration gets handled if it's, we're funding X percent of the project. And Madam Chair, I apologize if it's something you've covered already.
No, we're just getting into it. Representative Hausman is number two.
Well, I think for now, I guess that was just this bit of confusion that I saw throughout here, but I'll just keep paying attention to the question.
Representative Hansen, do you want to address what Representative Loeffler just brought up?
Yes, and Representative Loeffler, I talked earlier about one specific project in terms of the leveraging, but overall, $1 of outdoor heritage funds will bring in an additional 50 cents of non-state funds. That's across the whole proposal. We can provide the committee with specific leveraging for projects, if you would like that.
And Madam Chair, just follow up. As we're trying to think through on all these funds, how do we consistently sort of deal with things? Did you get into discussing whether that would be like part of the contract, or wouldn't, until the additional money is raised, our money isn't let out, or it's sort of matched as it's earned? I'm still thinking practical things about how it works. Mr. Becker.
Representative Loeffler. The language in the bill does not specify the matches. Were it specify the match, then there would have to be a legally binding guarantee before the project can start. The experience that I've had with other funds doing this way, and that the legislature has had with other funds doing it this way, leads me and the managers of other funds to conclude that it's better to manage the match through the work program in some cases, or accomplishment plan in other cases, and the contract itself, as opposed to putting it in the appropriations language. So I think that when you think about this, there are some instances where a match may fail, but the project may go forward. But that's not the majority of the instances. It's left up to the administrating bodies to ensure that the state gets value for its dollar.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to thank the members of the LaSard Outdoor Heritage Commission for doing their job. Now it's time for this committee to do our job. A couple questions here. First of all, the expenditure proposed is $69,522,000. How did you, Representative Hanson, I guess I'll go through you, how did the commission come up with that number? Are we putting some in reserve? Did we have available $80 million, and we're going to look at $69 million? Then I've got a follow-up question.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative David, according to the February forecast, I believe we have $77,700,000 roughly that's anticipated to come in from July 1 this year to June 30th next year. The dollars do not start to come in until July 1. We will not really see them until about August 15th. And so you're going to build up the fund, the Outdoor Heritage Fund, during that time. The council made a decision to hold back roughly 10%. So that's why we get to the 69.5. And just in terms of process, as we looked at the project, each council member was given about this amount of dollars to pick projects, and we all went through a spreadsheet and made recommendations and came back and voted on those. So we built in that reserve at this level because just with the economy and the anticipated volatility of the sales tax.
Madam Chair, and
Representative Davis,
Representative Hanson, what were the total requests to the Outdoor Heritage Council?
Madam Chair and Representative David, my name is Mike Kilgore. I'm the chair of the LaSard Outdoor Heritage Council. We received 99 proposals that totaled approximately $250 million in requests. And just to add to that, in talking to the people who proposed the projects, in some areas that was a disciplined request. We had a number of criteria, 16 to be specific, that needed to be met by any proposal coming before the council, and we had 6 priority criteria, including one like Representative Loeffler mentioned of a match. And so in talking to some of those project proposers, the amount that they requested, and they had to be ready to go. In other words, they couldn't be a thought, but they had to be, for example, a willing seller or a program that was ready to provide to a wildlife management area system acquisition or whatever, that the amount that they actually requested was less than what they could have. So when I tell you $250 million in request, it likely could have been considerably higher than that.
Okay. And Madam Chair,
Representative Davis,
Representative Hanson, on page 15, lines 15.32 through the end of the page, it says regarding purchases of recycled, repairable, and durable materials. I understand recyclable materials, but what's in the category of repairable and durable materials? What are we talking about there?
Mr. Kilgore has given me the statute that talks about statute 16B.121, purchase of recycled, repairable, and durable materials. And
I mean, Madam Chair and Representative Hanson, what are we repairing? What's a repairable material?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Becker.
Representative Davis, the intent here is to guide, in terms of statute, state agencies to purchase things that will last a long time and not go into the waste stream. So by repairable, they mean items that can be, if they fail, not thrown away but brought back into use. Reusable or durable, excuse me, they're attempting to prohibit the purchase of one-time throwaway things. So you would buy an old coffee pot with the, that percolates instead of one with a paper filter that you toss out.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. And just in conclusion here, Representative Howes brings up something that is very concerning to me, and not to revisit that right now, but on bottom of page 3 and top of page 4, I do have a lot of concerns about going with the United States Fish and Wildlife Service rather than the DNR, and I think it would be worth it to keep it in the state possession, even with the toll payments that are involved. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was writing as fast as I can as you were presenting, and it would be really helpful for me, Representative Hanson, if those wonderful notes that you had that said what each section does would be provided, that would be helpful. So my question is, as I was listening and trying to take some notes real quick, are there any, with our, one of our goals being balanced across the state, were there any ecological sections of the state that have been left out or county areas that have been left out in this proposal?
Is Dr. Kilgore.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Brown, there will be at least 77 of the 87 counties receiving money from the fund. When I say at least, two key projects we could not include because the Wetland Reserve RIM program, which is a $9 million recommendation, that is based on a sign-up which has yet to occur. I believe, and I would have to defer to Mr. Becker, but I believe that all of the sections would have dollars flowing into them. Probably the one area, although it's within the Arrowhead section, I believe the Sucker River project, aquatic restoration project, is probably as far northeast in Minnesota as the outdoor heritage dollars flow.
Ms. Vendrell? Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Kilgore, I'm trying to, I guess, get a little firmer handle on the criteria that was used, and I know you mentioned, you know, the multiple benefits, and you talked about leveraging federal funds and leveraging other resources as well. But I was wondering if some criteria was given more weight than others, and maybe I can give you a couple of examples of projects that didn't make the cut. And I understand that there's limitations; you had to make the cut someplace. But if there were certain things that, if it didn't meet the criteria, it was off the table. Because I'm thinking of two projects in the Red River Valley in particular, and in light of what's been happening up there with the flooding situation, I think, made the needs that they're facing up there much more visible. But we have the Red Path project and the North Ottawa Impoundment project, which both address the storm reduction issue and flood damage reduction issue through flood storage, but it did have a number of other, both of these projects had multiple benefits to them that included not just flood damage reduction, but also flow augmentation downstream. You had wetland restoration. You had habitat provided for waterfowl, northern pike spawning habitat, stream corridor restoration, water quality improvement. All of these things were included in both of those projects. And I was just wondering, is there what would have been the reason for those not making the cut? Was there something that wasn't there that took it off the table?
Madam Chair and Representative Eakin, no. We had 99 projects. We recommended funding for less than one out of every five. There were a tremendous number of wonderful habitat protection, restoration, enhancement projects we simply couldn't fund, not because they lacked certain characteristics. It's simply we didn't have the funds to deal with all the project requests. I guess the other thing, I guess we've been telling people that came to us that didn't receive funding, this is the first of a 25-year effort, and so we will be making a second set of recommendations within 8 months to you on the fiscal 11 appropriation. So we certainly had a lot of needs, a lot of worthy projects that simply didn't get funded, not due to the virtues of what they were proposing that was the funding limitation.
Okay, and Madam Chair, Mr. Kilgore, one of the reasons I was wondering that about the only thing that I didn't see, I guess, was as far as access to hunting. I know that wasn't part of it, but I was wondering how much weight is given to that over other criteria. Or
Madam Chair and Representative Eaton, the Constitution directs about the access for hunting and fishing. The Constitution, as Representative Hansen said, specifies that if the land is acquired by fee title, that it has to remain open to public hunting and fishing unless otherwise specified. So that's a constitutional provision.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen, I have a few questions, I guess, that are PILT related here. One example, I think Accelerated Prairie Grassland, just sticking that one out. You said basically 3.9 million in the fiscal year 2010, and then 28,000 in PILT. Does that come out of that total? Is that included in the total of the appropriation?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, no.
Okay. Madam Chair?
And Madam
Representative
Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Representative Erdahl, I encourage you to take a look at the council, and I believe the legislature has been struggling with the issue of would this fund. And you should have in your packet a very recent opinion from the Attorney General's office dated April 7th that discusses the ability or inability of using the constitutional dollars relating to PILT.
Okay.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your answer on that. Do you have figures on the total PILT dollars that are expended in this?
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, we estimate that it's approximately $130,000 yearly.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Representative Erdahl.
So, you also know what the total number of tax dollars then taken off the roll would be. What this takes place of.
Mr. Becker.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, yes, we do. It's approximately $13 million. I can get you the exact figure as we know it.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erdahl.
I'm just making sure that I have this straight. So you're saying that $13 million is coming off and it's being replaced with $130,000?
Oh, no. Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, the $13 million is the acquisition value.
Okay.
I apologize.
Do you have what the tax would be on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, I do not know what the tax would be on that.
Okay.
Depends on which precise parcels were purchased.
But we can get that information, can't we?
Madam Chair, we can make an approximation of what it might be based on the average tax rate in the county. But precise number would be very difficult to come by because these purchases are being made from lists of willing sellers. We don't know the precise property that's going to be purchased.
But we can make approximate
and
that are fairer than the $13 million, that are more true to the number than $13 million.
Madam Chair, I will do my best to get you that number.
We would appreciate that a lot because we are very concerned about the PILT payment. And we are going to continue to be concerned no matter how we read the letter from the Attorney General.
Just finishing up, Madam Chair.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. I appreciate your responses. And I'm not expecting exactly to the penny number, but just if we could have a pretty decent idea of what's going on with that.
We can provide that, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Mr. Becker. Representative Regina.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen and Dr. Kilgore, I apologize for not being here for the presentation. We all are having other bills up at this time. But I did get a chance to read the bill, and one thing just struck me as I was reading it, and it was about the proportionality of how the dollars are being allocated. And here's the way I think about it. In Minnesota, we own 4.5 million acres of forest. We have lost about half of our wetlands, but we have still about half of our wetlands. And generously speaking, we may have 175,000 acres of prairie left. And the last testimony I heard from DNR is that it's still disappearing. So when I read up and added up the numbers in here, it seemed to be inverse. The most money went to forests, the middle amount went to wetlands, and the least amount went to prairies. And then I read it more carefully, and it looked like in the prairies, most of it was for acquisition, and when it was listed under prairie, a lot of it was listed as grassland, and it wasn't ever going to be restored as prairie, just restored as hunting habitat. So what I added up was less than 10% of the money was going to go for acquisition of prairie, and the only thing that I could see for restoration of prairie was $462,000 that was directed at that. And so I ask you about the proportionality and why that kind of decision was made. I particularly would draw your attention back to the statute that created the council. And it highlighted three things beyond the Constitution. And what the highlight was, and that prevents forced fragmentation, encourage forest consolidation, and expand restored native prairie. But in nowhere do I see here that that's happening. So help me out with the proportionality issue here. Dr. Kilgore?
Madam Chair and Representative Wagenius, the first project under prairie, $1.7 million in this year, is for the restoration and enhancement of native prairie vegetation. You're right, we do have a part for the acquisition of permanent conservation easements on some of the remnant prairies in the southeast floodplains, but we do have some money there. There is also money for native prairie restoration or protection through the National Fish and Wildlife Service project, the I forget the title, but the grassland refuge system, northern tall grass prairie refuge system. And there are, and Madam Chair, there are representatives here who could speak to, at least from the state's perspective, some of the specific native prairie projects and the restoration or protection activities.
Representative Genius, what I couldn't see was in the bill or even in the work plan, because a lot of what I saw was or grassland, and native prairie and grasslands are not the same, but that is my concern. And we did look through the more specific projects, and it's not the question of whether there's some little pieces for prairie. It's the proportionality issue, with most of the money going to the thing that we have the most of. Can you help me out there? Yeah.
Representative Wagenius, I think we have a breakdown a spreadsheet here that we can maybe at one of the pages make a copy of, but I'm not sure we provided at the first. But we can.
Representative Wagenius. Well, thank you. I actually did take an opportunity to read the bill, though, and read the work plans, and this proportionality issue still strikes. So, That's a concern I have. But let's see. So the most money went to the forest, and my concern, well, let me, before I, maybe I don't have a concern there, but did you bring us a copy of the proposed contract between DNR and Blandon, or PMI?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, we did not, it's my understanding that that is not public yet.
Madam Chair and Representative Wagenius, in talking to the state manager of that project, in fact, we do have someone here who can speak for the Forest Legacy Project if you wish, but Craig Engwall, the regional administrator, who is a point person for the state, told me yesterday the state and the Blandon Paper Company have come to terms of agreement on the easement project that will be made public. That hasn't been made public yet, but the agreement has been reached between the company and the state on the terms of that easement.
Genius. But it's the terms that I am interested in, I don't want to hear testimony. I want to read what's in the document, because I have heard testimony about easements before and read what's in the document and found that they were two different things. So, I have understood before that the state has had when folks negotiate for pieces of land, that DNR keeps that private until it's finished. But there's a good reason for that sometimes, and that's because there might be a competitor out there, and you don't want to tip your hand to a competitor. But in this case, I can't see that there's a competitor out there saying, hey, we're going to give this amount of money. So I do think that legislators should see a copy of the contract before we vote on it. It would be one thing. And here's my very specific reason for wanting that. When we've had discussions about our forest, we've had discussions about what's going to happen in climate change. And members, I just pulled out of one of our LCCMR documents, and here, why don't I ask Paige for him to hand this out. This is from one of the proposers of an LCCMR project. It wasn't done for this discussion we were having here, but this is Professor Peter Wright, the Regents Professor and Senior Professor of Tree Physiology and Forest Ecology. And at the bottom of this page, if members have it, it says, it's nice to read the whole thing, but it says, as climatic points like this move, so move the environments of Minnesota. If this point continues its path for 70 more years, Minnesota will be reduced to a prairie state without its native pines and forests. So the words of management in that easement are critical. And I think that's one of the issues that we have to wrestle with. I can't wrestle with it without knowing what's in that contract. Can you help me out here, Dr. Kilgore?
Dr. Kilgore.
Madam Chair, Mr. Dick Peterson is here in the audience. He can certainly speak to, he's been involved. I have not been involved in negotiations of the terms of the easement, specifically the rights and the management obligations of the state or the owner, but Mr. Peterson is.
Well, Representative Virginia, so I actually want to hear from the Heritage Council members and the due diligence with regard to climate change and how our forests will be changing. And what you are telling folks who are negotiating. That's my key issue here.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Mr. Becker.
Representative Wagenius, as I understand it, what you want is protected by state statute and can't be turned over. So you've developed sort of a catch-22 here. At the earliest possible point in the process of doing the acquisition, that information can be turned over as soon as it's made public. But it's just not public at this point.
Representative Virginia.
Well, then let me ask what the council has directed with regard to the negotiations about how the land is to be managed given the fact of climate change.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Becker.
Representative Virginia. I think what the council has done is relied on the statutes on the Forest for the Future program to guide the development of the easement terms. That's our best benchmark touchstone that we have.
Representative Virginia.
Well, I checked on the statutes that you cited, and for a forest management plan, and it says you got to have goals, inventory, description of soil, aerial photo, proposed future conditions of land, how are you going to meet the proposed future conditions, timetable for activities. It's so general, and it never mentions climate change. So I'm still wanting to understand. I would just leave it at that.
Representative Hanson.
Madam Chair, and I can speak to the appropriation amount because we put in $20 million. We know that is not enough, and that's why we have the statement about this is the first payment of a ongoing because we know that the $20 million will not cover that. We had that discussion in the council. That's a different discussion than what Representative Wagenius is saying, but in terms of dealing with this proposal, it's larger than $20 million, and so but we look at all the other projects that we had come in and didn't want to we wanted to have some of that balance across the area. So, but we do have the actual staff person here to probably answer the specific question.
And does the actual staff person wish to make an attempt? Did I get it? Mr. Peterson, is this?
Yes. For the record, Madam Chair, my name is Richard Peterson, and I'm the Forest for the Future coordinator for the Minnesota DNR. And Madam Chair, Representative Wagenius, without getting into all of the, and I don't have a copy with me, but your question as to how the easement addresses forest management and climate change was addressed in a couple of ways. You hit on one. And that was that we do require a state-approved forest management plan. And unlike the terms of the easement, the forest management plan is an adaptive document. That is, as conditions of the land change, so long as the management is consistent with the terms of the easement, certain management can be changed over time. And so as the climate warms and we get different forest types or different species combinations occurring, the land could be managed differently. That is, instead of a northern spruce fir forest that has conditions caused the climate to change and it became more like an oak forest, the management plan could allow the landowner to adapt to the changing species that were best suited for the climate. But I think even more importantly, the conservation easement requires that the landowner, in this case it is UPM, but it could be any future owner, is bound to the same terms that they are required to manage the land according to an ecological classification system. And specifically, it has to be something like our native plant community classification system. So the management of an individual part of their property would have to be consistent with what the native plant community system would allow. Does that answer your question?
Representative Virginia.
Not at all. And the reason is, you said, you began with saying, as long as it's consistent with the easement, then the management plan can do this. The real legal document is the easement, not the management plan. So I then come back to thinking, well, what is in this easement? And then we hear from Professor Reich that this is going to be reduced to a prairie state without its native pines and forests. So the management, the transition here, is immensely important. And it's got to be terms of the easement, not terms of a management plan. Because the management, I mean, if the easement isn't written right, and I've seen some of the easements, and we've had this conversation before, that would not be helpful.
Madam Chair?
Peterson.
Representative Wagenius, I think, in fact, the easement is, as you correctly stated, the defines the terms of how the land can be used, restrictions, and what can be allowed. The easement cannot be so prescriptive, knowing that climate is dynamic, that the landscape will be dynamic. The easement is not so prescriptive as to say it has to be managed exactly for the conditions that are on the land today. And for that reason, it provides for two directions in the easement. The easement provides the current managers and future managers with a flexible opportunity to manage, given that climate will likely change, or if climate doesn't change, certain conditions on the land will change. And it lays out the guidelines for what needs to be in a management plan, and more importantly, it lays out the requirement that the native plant communities that are present on the site will dictate how the land is managed. I guess I don't quite understand your reasoning.
Well, my reasoning is that, from Dr. Reich, he said that it will be without its native pines and forests, so the native plant communities will not be there. So it's this transition, and how we're going to deal with it. I mean, we are promising, in a way, that this is going to be a forest, and that's the way all this has been sold, and I don't think that's going to happen. I think we are going to have to manage for a different climate. I want to know how well managed it is going to be, and I'm not comfortable yet with how well managed. Is this going to be a big weed patch, or how are we going to deal with invasives? I mean, these are big questions that we've been asking in committee, and the invasive issue is just huge, and I don't know how. We're just asking questions so we can be comfortable knowing that this will not be one gigantic weed patch with invasives.
Sure, Madam Chair.
Mr. Peterson.
Representative Wagenius, I think one of the things that helps to protect any property from invasives is maintaining large intact landscapes, whether or not they're prairie or forest or any other habitat. The less intrusion there is from nodes of development or roads or whatever lines of or paths that invasives have to get into a property, doing exactly what this easement does, which is to consolidate and protect large blocks, is exactly one of the strategies that should be and is recommended for invasives. To look at the the climate change scenario, the same reasoning applies. We want to maintain large blocks of habitat so that there can be a natural migration of species northward or southward to northward, if that in fact is what happens in the future. Maintaining these large connected habitat blocks and corridors is the key strategy to helping species adapt to climate change. If we left isolated parcels like we have in the big woods, I can see that being a very big issue, because species that aren't mobile will have a hard time leapfrogging from friendly habitat to friendly habitat. In these northern woods, where we have an opportunity to maintain large contiguous blocks, this is exactly what we need to do to adapt to climate change, and I'm sure Professor Reich would agree. I guess I disagree in the sense that he's saying this is going to turn into a prairie in northern Minnesota within 70 years. I'm not sure what climate model he's using, but I suspect we may have a different species mix over time occurring if the climate changes up there, but I guess I don't see northern Minnesota being a prairie in 7 years. Whether or not it's a prairie, whether or not it's a northern prairie or a more southerly type forest system, like an oak type dominated system, we still have the forest, at least in part, in the future, I believe. I haven't seen anything published by Professor Reich that indicates 70 years from now we're going to have a prairie in north central Minnesota.
You used the word natural migration, and I think that what climate change folks tell us is there won't be natural migration. So what we may want to do is to make sure that there is managed, that this forest now will be managed in a way that can accommodate not having natural migration, because that's not what we expect. That's not what we expect under climate change. And those are the kinds of questions that we ask a lot about in our environment committee. And so I just think it's important to hear some of the questions that we're asking.
And I think we will probably continue to have new questions in the next several days as we're reviewing this. But thank you for your testimony, your answers, and please leave your phone numbers so that we can call you in the meantime. Representative Hansen, before we leave this subject altogether, you said, we know that the $20 million is not enough and that there will be another figure coming. Is that in the second year? Is that what you're saying?
That's, Madam Chair, that's what the council was anticipating. I think there may be, now that there's kind of a finalization of price, I think that may be a little late. In terms of there, so I
and then there was another question that came up that before we leave this topic that we should probably ask: how could we have a contract? How could we negotiate a contract for something before the money is appropriated?
I think we've done that. Mr. Peterson just left the room. Oh, he's back here. Oh, he's, I think he's signing in. He may. I think we had a direct question on authority.
You indicated, Representative Hansen, that Dr. Kilgore, Mr. Peterson had negotiated a contract and that there was agreement on both sides between the state and the company. Am I correct?
Madam Chair, I wouldn't term what we've agreed to a contract at this point. What we have reached is an agreement on the terms of the easement, largely. We still have some points that are in discussion, but largely the easement terms have been agreed to. We have made an offer on price that has, and I haven't seen that document, as was indicated earlier. Craig Engwall, our regional manager in North, located in Grand Rapids, made that offer, and it was accepted, so we have an agreement on price. We are obviously, any offer we have is contingent on funds being available, and funds being available in a timely way. So at this point, we don't have what I would consider a legal and binding contract. The owners have indicated that when funds have been appropriated, they would be willing to enter into a legal and binding contract or purchase agreement.
Okay, that clarifies somewhat. But except that, just that timely way, and an amount will be agreed upon to be paid in a timely way. How long is a timely way?
The Madam Chair, the owners, in this case, UPM Kimmeny, is indicating they would like to have final payments by December of 2010, or a year from this next December. And so what that might entail is a payment for appropriations totaling the required amount be made available by such time as December of 2010.
Okay. Calendar year.
Calendar year.
Representative Houston, on that point.
I don't know who would answer this. Why wouldn't we bond for that? Are we talking about purchase of land?
The easement.
So,
purchase of easement.
Madam Chair, both.
Yeah, Madam Chair, what the total project, as was indicated earlier, is two components. The vast majority, 287 acres, is for an easement, and 1,344 acres is for fee title. So it's the prices that are the amounts that have been agreed to include both the fee and the easement, but the easement is the largest portion.
Mr. Becker?
Madam Chair, Representative Hoffman, the essence of your question is why not bond for it? And I think the answer is twofold. Not to pay the interest, which is the obvious one, and then not to forego future opportunities as a result of funds committed to bond. We have the cash flow. Under the terms that we just described, if we make the appropriations to fund it as current funds.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Representative Morgan.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And Dr. Kilgore, Mr. Becker, Representatives Hansen and Gunther, and everybody else is on the committee, thank you very much for all your work. It seems like you spent a lot of time. You were very committed, very serious about the work. You had to make some tough choices. And if there's one thing we up here can sympathize with you about this year, it's going to be tough choices. You went from, I think, 99 projects to 18. Could you talk to us in the process of doing this about your priorities and your criteria? Specifically, I would ask you to address how science was part of your criteria and your priorities to winnow those projects down to that number.
Madam Chair and Representative Morgan, you're absolutely right. Science really was at the front and center. Science and the best practices that come from science for resource management. We spent a lot of time, as I mentioned, the last time we were before this committee, talking about the process we used. We included in our call for proposals the need to have whatever management restoration work done is based on the best science and practices. But we also spent quite a bit of time reviewing the resource management plans, be they statewide plans, habitat-specific plans, or this species-specific plans, for example, pheasant or wild turkey. And the goals and the role that science played in the development in each one of those long-range plans and the goals for those. So as we went through our deliberations and our review of the 99 proposals, that really was our guiding star, which was what does the science say and what do the best practices say about how best to restore a wetland. And let me give you an example, if I may. One of the things we learned was that the manner in which you restore wetlands makes a huge difference in terms of the habitat benefits that are generated. So it's not necessarily restoring a wetland in any way, but a certain way. For example, in large wetland complexes, in areas like the Prairie Pothole region of southwest Minnesota that has lost well over 90% of its wetlands, in an area where you have wetlands surrounded by habitat, upland habitat for nesting and other root cover, and so those types of things, which is where science tells us how to restore wetlands to be the most effective for habitat, were the types of things that we looked at when we reviewed the proposals and made our recommendations.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that. I appreciate it. And I would assume that there was some good science in all 99 of the projects. And what you're saying is that there was better science in the 18 that you chose, Dr. Kilgore?
Madam Chair and Representative Morgan, I would say that science was front and center, in my opinion, all 99 proposals. It came down to lots of good projects that didn't get funded because of funding limitations. I will tell you that the 18 that we are recommended are grounded in good science and best practices.
Okay.
But that's not to say the others that we didn't recommend weren't.
Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. Dr. Kilgore, let me, Representative Eakening, I see he's not here right now, but he specifically mentioned a couple of projects in the Red River Valley, and we know of their recent problems. Were there any other, perhaps, wetland restoration projects or any other projects that may have helped to mitigate some of their flood issues that were rejected, in addition to the two that he mentioned?
Madam Chair and Representative Morgan, there may have been some specific wetland projects within, because our recommendations, our 18, largely focus on building program capacity, for example, acquisition of wetlands and restoration of wetlands either through Board of Water and Soil Resources, the RIM, WRP, or the Wildlife Management Area System. And most of the projects, most of the programs we're making recommendations for are not funded at the level requested. There are a few exceptions. And so my guess is some of those where we have willing sellers or restoration activities that were initially proposed, only a portion of those would not be funded. And so there's probably some that are located in the Red River Valley.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you again, Madam Chair. The $20 million for this forest easement project that's been discussed most recently. We just had a conversation about the negotiations and so forth. Is that a $20 million or nothing? Is that Representative Hansen mentioned that there may be a request for additional funding in the next year's cycle. Is that a project that we could go back and do a little bit less this year and a little bit more next year if we decided that some of these Red River Valley projects, because of the flooding issues, might be a higher priority this year than maybe you would have thought 6 weeks ago?
Madam Chair and Representative Morgan, on that particular one, the total price tag for that project that's presented to us was around $50 million for it's mostly permanent conservation easements, but also a bit of fee acquisition, 1,300 acres. So what we are recommending is roughly half of that amount. It's my understanding that the state intends to close by the end of calendar year 2010. So whether the appropriation is $20 million this year and $20 million next year or some other combination, I think the key is that their interest in closing on the property by the end of the calendar year 2010.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Morgan.
A couple more questions here, specifically about what we adopted unanimously as a committee, and I'm sure you've seen this at this point. We adopted this on the 9th of March, our constitutional amendment investment goals, and I know we adopted that pretty close to the end of the council's deliberations. So obviously that was probably too late for you to adopt it yourself, or at least consider it too closely for all of your considerations. My question to you, Dr. Kilgore, having seen it, and it's been about 6 weeks since it's come out, what do you think of it, and would you consider taking it back to the council for the council's adoption for any future decisions that you have to make?
Madam Chair and Representative Morgan, when I was before this committee a couple of weeks ago, one of the specific things that Madam Chair asked me to report on or reflect on was how our work either aligned or didn't align with your 12 goals. And so, and I believe we certainly can provide you the PowerPoint, but I briefly walked through each of the 12 goals you set and gave you my personal opinion, not the corporate opinion of the council, because we hadn't had a chance to talk about it. So, and I can share those with you if you'd like. I actually have some of them in front of me, but certainly, you know, we can bring that before the council for review as well, if that's the wishes of this committee.
Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, Dr. Kilgore, thank you. I personally would appreciate that, and I'll leave it to the committee to direct you otherwise. But my question to you directly is, do you see these worthy of adoption by the council, and would you recommend their adoption to the council?
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, as I mentioned in the committee hearing a couple of weeks ago, there are some that are more pertinent than others to the work of the council. So, for example, and I'm reviewing on the fly, so please pardon me for that. Number five, which is prevent pollution and restore impaired waters. Certainly a worthy goal, certainly if not an indirect, possibly a direct outcome of some of the projects that we're recommending, particularly that relates to wetland restoration. And so it's certainly a common byproduct of our investments, but I would say it's probably not a direct outcome. And I believe, and again, I'm just recalling from memory, there might be a couple others that certainly we wouldn't disagree with them. It just may be that they might not be as germane to the Outdoor Heritage Fund.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you again, Dr. Kilgore.
Representative Loeffler. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hansen and Dr. Kilgore, thanks for your work. I'm still a little confused about the money and how it gets spent and what the price tags are, so I hope you'll indulge me. I don't sit on the Environment Committee. I don't sit on the Bonding Committee, so maybe some around the table have a better sense of it than I do, but I do have a sense that the eyes of the public are going to be on this money more than anything else we appropriate, because there is a sort of standard ways of doing things, and because I think each person who voted yes has a certain ownership that may not be as typical as the things that they sent in on April 15th to refill our coffers. And so on the tax committee, we spent a lot of time this year talking about how do you value green acres, and so we have separate valuations for conservation lands of various types, and it's not easy, even just for tax assessments, and those are like people own the land. And then here we have the concept of an easement, which is really sort of a, as I understand it, kind of a deed covenant that sort of carries forward into the future, and I'm glad they're permanent because I think that's part of the legacy. But I'm trying to understand, how do we make sure that we're smart buyers? Because none of us want to be embarrassed a few years from now when somebody says, man, the state of Minnesota paid X for this and the last six pieces around it sold for Y. And we've got here a whole bunch of purchasing agents, and, you know, from the state that we've heard about with the forest, easements and land and lands, to nonprofit organizations that I don't know if they have even a track record of buying and managing land. And then I heard the concept of willing sellers, which means
says to me almost like the land's already been identified, and so it's not like a competition on we're going to go out and find the best thing at the best price for these many acres. And I'm just a little confused, and maybe it's like I say, because I don't sit on these other things, but how do you value an easement? How are we going to assure the taxpayers that we're getting the right value and that we're getting it in the right point in the cycle? Because our real estate values are, you know, going all over the place right now. So if you can help me just kind of, if you spent any time as a commission or why you decided to have so many different purchasers rather than create a purchasing office that would really kind of develop some expertise and some standardization. Mr. Becker.
I'll start. That's a big question.
Well, it's a big amount of money, so it should be a big question.
Let me just start with you. That the council, by and large, invested in established programs, whether they be restoration or acquisition programs, that have professional staff and are, in many cases, most cases, governed by state statutes or agreements that implement state statutes on the non-governmental acquirers. The state statutes require that, so let's start out with the list of willing sellers. Those are generally winnowed from a larger group of people who are interested in preserving their property. And the state professional employees who are versed in grasslands, wetlands, prairies, things of that sort, evaluate and rank them, and then they work off of that list, not necessarily in the rank order list of the list, but in the rank order of the availability of the land. The price we pay is determined by statute or by agreement to be based on an appraisal that is an approved appraisal. And generally the limits are the same limits that are in statute, which indicate that you can't, except in certain exceptions, offer more than the appraised value. Often what the recipients are doing of the funds from the state is they deal with the willing landowner. They will attempt to buy at less than appraised value and provide the seller with benefits that are non-cash benefits, I guess you could say. So in the main, we've invested in programs that have a vetting process that vetted by professionals, that the state regularly invests money in, and that have access to the expertise such as the Attorney General's Office, professional appraisers, and things of that sort to ensure that the state drives a good bargain. I wouldn't say a hard bargain, but a good bargain. And we attempt to, through agreement, have those same procedures and rules work on the non-governmental acquirers.
And if I could just follow up.
Dennis, you've lost, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Becker, how about the valuation of an easement? And once again, you didn't address why we wouldn't want to have a central acquisition. Having the advice of some of these groups that know about habitat or whatever, advising on what to look for, but why not have a central sort of expertise to actually do the negotiating rather than just giving them a set of state directives and hope and they'll learn to follow them.
Madam Chair, Representative Glossman, let me start with an attempt to explain how you estimate the value of an easement. And essentially what you do is take a look at the value of the property without the easement, and then based on comparables, and the value of property with similar easements. And so you have a difference between the two, and that's the cost of the easement
the value of the equipment. I think the other question that you posed is a more challenging question, and I can give you my personal philosophy about using non-governmental organizations to acquire land, and that is that it builds the conservation community. They have the skills and capacity. It involves the citizens of Minnesota in the management of their outdoor of the resources. And not only do we acquire land at a reasonable price because it's governed by these laws and statutes or interpretations of those in agreements, but we build the conservation community for a stronger tomorrow. I really think that's why you involve them. The history of this, to my knowledge, goes back 20 years, and some original funding for the Pheasants Forever. And in that particular case, the non-governmental organizations indicated they could do it better, faster, less expensive. That, I think, the verdict is out on. I won't make a judgment about that. But I think the building of the conservation community is the real benefit state getting out of this. And we're getting the land without employing state employees. So.
And Madam Chair,
excuse me a minute. What was that last sentence? You're getting the land with...
We reduce the number of state employees that we have to have.
Representative Lofter.
Madam Chair, that's not necessarily my goal, but I do think building up expertise really does make a difference. And so you can use the expertise of the conservation community to tell you what to look for, but in doing the deal, I think the more you do it, the better you get at doing the deal. So I would hope that we would think about that just as I'm learning about it. When you say the willing sellers, if I owned a nice chunk of property that my family has treasured and that I love the wildlife and its value, can I put a piece of property on that willing sellers list and then have you evaluate it as something that could potentially be preserved forever? Mr. Becker.
That happens every day.
And then, Mr. Becker, if that happens, you'd invite these other groups in who have the habitat expertise, and they would look at this chunk of property and say, yeah, that fits what we do or don't want. And then you would send them, if it met their criteria, to negotiate with me?
Madam Chair, I would send the willing seller to the state program. They would then evaluate it. They might contact a non-governmental organization to make a purchase, or someone may directly contact a non-governmental organization. But you'll notice in the bill that all the acquisitions going to the state require the Commissioner of Natural Resources approval, and that's to ensure that they're of value relative to the known world of possible acquisitions that can be made for that program.
And Madam Chair, just one last question.
Lofler.
I have my wonderful little piece of heaven that I want to be there, a piece of heaven forever. So, and I go through that process. Would someone approach me and say, you know, we could offer you some money that you'd, but we could also give you a tax break for if you wanted to gift portion of this value or something like that? I mean, do we take those kinds of things into consideration?
Madam Chair,
Dr. Kilgore.
Representative Lofler, federal tax code, and I believe that state piggybacks as well, there are tax breaks for donated easements. And I'm not the expert on the specifics of that, but if you were to donate an easement, a portion of that value will give you a benefit for not only income tax purposes, but for estate tax purposes as well.
Thank you. That helps, Dr. Kilgore. So I'm hoping that as we move forward with this, we're encouraging people to look at that option, not just to get paid full value, but to look at
creating their own legacy gift in a different way than just doing a deal. Because that, I think there are a lot of people who might think that that was something that they would bequeath in a different way.
And Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, the state and other entities routinely get requests for donations of easements and or property without compensation. So I would hope members wouldn't get the impression that the only way an easement is acquired, either by a state or some other entity, is through an fee. Oftentimes, it's been that way in the past and continues to be. There are individuals like yourself with an altruistic goal of making sure that that land is protected that are willing to donate that value to the state or some other entity.
Were any of your 99 requests like that?
Madam Chair, all of them required money for an easement. However, I do recall, and there are some of the individuals in the room, where a good part of the value would be a donation from the landowner towards the value of that easement. So in other words, a non-cash contribution. So it could be at 50% of the easement or 75%. I don't recall the specifics, but I do recall with some of the proposals that there would be a less than full assessed value of the easement that would be compensated.
Could you tell us at a different time the portions of the bill, 2131, that has some of that kind of offset in it?
Madam Chair, one in particular that comes to mind is the Blufflands, and I know that Jane Prochaska is here, and if you could speak to that, if it's the request of the committee, just to hear how that process, I know there were others that had that same, I don't believe those were funded, but this one was funded, and that I know something that the Minnesota Land Trust pursues in their acquisitions quite routinely.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler?
If other people have questions, I went on a different topic, but I just don't want to monopolize.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering if the Minnesota Timberwolves lose their last game of the season to the worst team in the league and nobody's in attendance, did it really happen? I just wondering. one question, and I had to go down to tax committee for a little bit, but one question that I don't know if it's been answered is after the 25 years of the legacy program, okay, so you got this land in there like forever, permanent easements, like that's quite over, permanent easements, like that's quite a while.
Yeah.
What happens after the 25 years to the tilt payments or the maintenance on the land that has been acquired? Let's say in 25 years, they go out for another vote, it doesn't pass. What have we built up here as far as who pays the tilt payments, who pays for the maintenance of the properties that are now in the program from the legacy money?
Representative Hanson.
Madam Chair, Representative Davis, as you may know, the tilt obligation is ongoing.
So, Madam Chair, and Representative Hanson, where does it come from?
Madam Chair, it comes from Representative Wagenius' budget.
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Wagenius.
Representative Genius.
Thank you. Just to follow up on something that Mr. Becker, you answered to a question from Representative Loeffler. You said you were talking about, well, if the state ended up owning the land, who else might end up owning the land that is being funded by state dollars?
Madam Chair, Representative Wagenius, the county could. I don't think there's any city in this particular case. And as we've discussed already, the federal government could.
But if I could just Representative Wagenius. But let me follow up here and make sure that it would either be a unit of government. The people who paid for the money would still own the land. It would not ever end up being owned by a private
group.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Becker.
Representative Virginia, I know of no appropriations that would end up in that fashion.
Thank you.
And if someone knows of one, I'd like to know about it.
Thank you. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, many folks have said thank you for your work, and I second that and continue that thought. Maybe have a little more appreciation for what we do here at the Capitol, but really, thank you for your work and working on this. I just kind of want to start. I have a disappointment, a couple of them, but I'm going to start in the beginning. You know, a lot of us committee members around the table have spent a lot of time, and I look around the crowd, and beginning, we all had to bring in a pitcher, and quite honestly, I would like to see your pitchers, because I'm not a hunter that much, but I kind of like seeing deer, and I get like the outdoor news, and I look in there, and the big fish. I wanted someone to beat Larry's fish, Representative Howe's fish. But, you know, I guess I'm disappointed that you haven't participated here. We've had the arts folks here. We've had water folks here. We've had parks and trails folks. And so I just want to kind of say that I'm disappointed. And that, to me, that kind of goes into the question of Representative Morgan's, you know, about our goals and the kind of things that we've worked on. And I know that the horse has kind of left the barn, you know, for this year perhaps, or the John Deere tractors left that garage so we could have that food. But, you know, so maybe this year it's, you know, a little past us. But I really hope that you would take kind of, at least what I heard him maybe saying, is take this back and look at this, because this was really a group effort, and I think it was well thought out and reasonable in the sense of, you know, matching up to the goals of the Constitution. And so please consider that for next year, probably more so. You know, I think a lot is, you know, perhaps too far gone. On one second thought to that, though, I think, again, Mr. Representative Morgan had a good thought as far as maybe pulling your bill back and reconsidering a little bit on some of the Red River stuff for this year. I mean, certainly it's a great opportunity given the timing that you could adjust and perhaps improve. I don't know if that would make us, you know, we've got a lot of emails, many of us members, with calling us raiders of the amendment. I'm still trying to figure out what we've done to be raiders of the amendment, but maybe you can explain that to me at some point. So maybe if we offering the suggestion that we do the Red River thing would make me a raider. So maybe I'll be in the news tomorrow like Representative Hansen has. I just want to mention that's the Representative Hansen comment and some of the others have been a great disappointment to me, because I know quite well that he's a true believer, especially in your section of the pie, in the outdoors, and he's a true hunter, and I don't know if he fishes or not, but I know he hunts and shoots a lot of stuff, and he hasn't shot me, which I appreciate, so when I've been down on his farm, so I feel safe with him. But anyways, I just want to say I hope you guys do a better job again next year of supporting him, and because he really has done a great job of supporting you. Going back to the Constitution itself, I just want to mention, again, this is probably, again, for next year, and, you know, I don't have any great plans to cause you great chaos this year, but I really hope that you strive to reach goal number 8. And I did study and look at your PowerPoint, and you look at number 8 and how you responded to the geographical and fairness balance. And I'm just going to use an example of my Easter break. I went from the Twin Cities and I went to Lutzen and back, and passed a lot of nice state parks and trails and all sorts of stuff. And you know, I didn't see any fishing going on, or you know, that many people. But last night I was going home and I got 6 miles from here, and there was about 20 people fishing on a creek. So please consider the metro. There's a lot of folks down here that wanna. Granted, we probably can't shoot stuff, but you know, we definitely want to, you know, do some fishing down here too. So please try to do what you can in your piece of the pie to help it to help the cause, because there are a lot of people that want to do those sort of things down here, and maybe can't afford to go out state Minnesota. So anyways, there's some thoughts for next year, I think, and as we move forward. Again, I really do appreciate your work, and it's a huge task, and it's, you know, it's an exciting problem to, you know, given the budget situation we are in, to have a little money to spend, but, and it's, I know it's hard to cut, but please consider some of those thoughts. So thank you.
Just a brief response, and just for the information of the committee, that Representative Murphy and Representative Morgan, myself, and Mr. Becker met very early. I think I'm not sure if the committee had even formed. It had been formed. I don't know if you had met yet. We probably spent an hour and 15 minutes talking about the work of the LaSard Outdoor Heritage Council, the work of this committee, and opportunities that we can work through in this session. So just to let the committee members know, we did have that conversation quite early on in the session about what those opportunities were.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe I'm missing something here, but my good friend Representative Lilly made a suggestion or a comment that I need to question here. Representative Lilly said it's, for this year, it's too far gone. Unless I'm missing something, I couldn't disagree more. I don't think this is too far gone. I consider House File 2131 suggestions to the committee. And we will have plenty of amendments to rearrange things and do things as we please. And as far as the Raiders of the Lost Amendment thing, you can put a block on them so you don't get 85,000 of them a night. Mm-hmm. It works great because you never get them.
Yeah.
It works good.
Guess what? It may look like a lot, but I counted them up, and there aren't that many at all. I think for and I was one of the targets, so it was kind of fun to find out that there were. There weren't that many. It's just maybe you see them all at once, but a couple hundred maybe. That's nothing in our game.
Madam Chair and Representative Wagenius,
Representative.
When I started getting those, I would respond to them saying that, you know, we're going to be cutting education, we're going to be closing nursing homes, and here we've got to put this money in for this. I said if there was some way I could do it, I would, but I haven't quite figured out how yet. Then I blocked.
Will you talk to Mr. Chan about
Representative Loeffler? Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I got one from someone in my district. And I have seen people take the bus to get to with a fishing pole. Some of the things that we're doing here, I think many of the people I represent will not have a chance to see unless we do some things on access, like we're talking about doing with history and arts and funding buses and, you know, so who knows, maybe we're going to have a chance to knit the state together, which I hope is part of the legacy of all these funds, not any particular one. But we have had some incredibly lively discussions. One of my disappointments here is how much time we spend in geographic tensions. They're real. And we've had very lively debates about state parks, metro regional parks, creating new regional parks in other parts of the state. And I see on lines 2.27 and 2.28 something we've never talked about. And that is to the Southwest Initiative Foundation, which is another one of those things that there's none of those in the metro area, but we wish we had one with some McKnight money. They are going to acquire land to be added to the state outdoor recreation system. And in all of our debates and discussion about should there be a new regional system in greater Minnesota, comparable to the metro regional system, I've never heard that term. And it says it's a system. So if you could help me know what that is, that would be useful.
Mr. Becker. Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler. Mr. Cobb, who is with the Southwest Initiative Foundation, is here. If you have a specific question on that, Mr. Becker can answer that particular question.
Thank you. 86.
Just to clarify, it's not about what is the project. It is state outdoor recreation system, because I haven't seen those terms together. Mr. Becker.
Representative Loeffler. 86A is the chapter of state statutes that establishes the state outdoor recreation system and enumerates the various parts of it.
It includes state parks, state trails, state wilderness areas, for that matter, aquatic management areas, state forests, wildlife management areas, and I'm sure I'm scientific and natural areas, and I'm sure I'm missing at least one or two. But that's from my quick recollection what's in there. It also establishes the management of each of those and the goals of each of them. It's wonderful reading, and it's a very great statute for one that the state of Minnesota. That is a wonderful statute.
Well,
Mr. Becker, I really do like looking at things big and holistically, so that's helpful. But then will someone at some point take this land in Redwood County and say it fits in this definition within the state outdoor recreation system? They will say it's a state park, or it's a state forest, or it's a those long list of things that are included within the system?
Madam Chair?
Mr. Becker?
Given the constitutional restrictions on acquisitions, that will be done, and they will be limited primarily to an SNA,
SNA?
Scientific and natural area, which in certain cases can be hunted. A wildlife management area or an aquatic management area. So those would be the three most likely items. It could be added to the state forest system.
Thank you, Mr. Becker. That's useful, and I hope in the future when people propose these things, they actually tell us which one they think fits, because I see each of those as kind of a different sort of focus. The last thing I wanted to say and share with the committee, because I just think I need to do full disclosure, and Dr. Kilgore and I talked earlier today, is I actually presented a proposal to the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council on behalf of the Forest Protection Task Force, which I served on as a legislative member, but it was made up primarily of state and federal experts in forestry and the forest industries and the nursery and landscaping industry and the Minnesota Sage Tree Advisory Committee and local governments, townships, cities, counties, and its charge and law was to put together a plan to protect all of our forests from invasive pests, primarily insects. And they've come up with a pretty good start at a plan of how we can beat an invasive species and avoid the failures that other states have had. We looked at a GAO report that looked at how other states have lost the battle and what we would need to do in terms of investment and infrastructure to be able to succeed with that. And when we presented it, we had not had and didn't think we were hoping we wouldn't have emerald ash borer, one of our biggest threats in our state, because it had at that point been found on the eastern end of Wisconsin, and we thought there was more time. But unfortunately, just before our break, it was found in Representative David's Houston County, right on the border with Iowa and Wisconsin and Minnesota, and our Department of Ag and Natural Resources are working frantically to kind of see what the area is. And a lot of us who care about the health and protection of our forests are working together to try and gather quickly a lot of information about what the federal resources would be, what the others would be. And one of the recommendations from that was a reserve fund that could allow us, if that outbreak had been discovered when we weren't in session, to allow them to have some access to resources to quickly respond. And in some ways, I'm kind of glad that not all of the money was allocated, because in terms of the reserve fund, because I think we'll have to discuss with the Environment Committee what's available in current resources, with the federal government what's available there, and we're really kind of making this up quickly on the fly. But I just wanted to let people know that I actually did do that. I appreciated their willingness to listen to the council's recommendation. And at that time, we didn't see it as quickly an imminent threat as perhaps it is right now. And I think their definition at that point of forest protection was more narrow in terms of preventing forest fragmentation. So I just wanted to let people know that.
To that point, Representative David.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would like to thank Representative Loffler for her work on
that particular issue, and it does come home pretty close to me. Down there in Victory, Wisconsin, just across the river from Houston County, and I'm sure it's over the river by now. I can see an amendment on page 5 to some of the forest monies to take care of that, because what better way of preserving forest than to stop that pest from coming over. So, and I thank you on the work you've done so far.
Oh, yeah. Maybe we can build a fence at the reach. We wish it was that simple.
Representative Hansen, do you want to tell us a little bit more about the conversations that took place during the discussions on what projects to fund or not, and the question of urgency, and what if, like, what if we have severe floods in the Northwest, or what if we have forest bugs, or what if there's a huge grassland prairie fire within the year, and only 10% of the projected funding is set aside in the reserve.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we can make available the request for proposals that has the definitions of protect, enhance, and restore that went out and came back through the what the collaborative folks, and I do want to take a moment and acknowledge the number of project participants that are here that have been sitting if we have specific projects to ask questions about. During the discussion of the reserve, we had discussions about the volatility of the sales tax, the state of the economy, but we did also talk about it as a reserve. There were some discussions about things come up during the year, but I think primarily we were talking about, and other council members can correct me if I'm wrong, but about volatility, economic uncertainty. But I believe in the LCCMR there is an emerging issues account that has been set up to take when there are things that occur that may occur when we are not in session, that there would be the ability to respond to. I think that we discussed that as having some type of thing, because we're not always in session.
Thankfully. Mr. Becker?
To Representative Hansen's last point, one of the things in drafting the bill that was not inserted in it was a way to pass the reserve in the event of an emerging issue or an emergency, which is essentially to use the, I believe it's the Legislative Advisory Committee and or the governor's signature to, in fact, make the money available. And if you're interested in that, where you would look, I believe, is in the LCCMR bill, and their staff is intimately familiar with how that works.
Dr. Kilgore, you, in your remarks, you talked about telling people that if their project didn't get in or their program didn't get in this year, there was 24 more years. Do you think that next year's bill will be very similar to this year's bill with the type of project?
Madam Chair, I think it will be similar. Probably more similar than different, but we're going to be going through a different process. Obviously, by necessity, had put a bill together in 4 months.
We acknowledge that.
Right. And so I think you'll see, again, we can only do three things, or recommend three things: restoration, protection, and enhancement in the four resource areas, forest, prairies, wetlands, fish, game, and wildlife habitat. There will certainly be new stuff, but I suspect that overall they will likely see a lot of the restoration enhancement activities that we're recommending here continued on, because as I mentioned, for some of those projects, For most of them, we weren't able to fund them at the full amount that was requested.
Representative Regina. Thank you. That's very troubling to me. I was going to ask if you would please break out grasslands and prairie, because they are not the same. Grassland may be better under habitat, not good necessarily habitat, but under habitat, to know how much real prairie, how much native Minnesota prairie we are going to restore. So that would be helpful to have this redone. But when I hear that things are going to be very similar, and when I know that we're losing prairie, and it is the ecology that we have the least of, and it's the most vulnerable, it troubles me to think that it will get the least attention.
Madam Chair, and Representative Lagina, I didn't say that it would get the least attention. I was speculating on the process and the outcomes, and I would say overall, if you look at the types of projects for funding of restoration, protection, and enhancement, you will likely see a number of the same types of things that we're recommending here. But beyond that, it's pure speculation.
Representative Hodgson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just reading through and the wildlife habitat portion, and I wonder, do we only care about wildlife we can shoot?
Madam Chair, I think if we go back to the constitutional language, it does talk about fish, game, and wildlife habitat. So game is in the open season, but wildlife is broader. So wildlife habitat is broader than game.
So where it says everywhere you have to be able to hunt, it doesn't mean necessarily all the wildlife has to be huntable.
Correct.
That we're restoring habitat for.
Correct.
Mr. Decker?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think that's a really good point to bring out, that the open for hunting during the hunting season doesn't apply to the restoration, doesn't apply to the enhancement. And the council discussed this, and I think that there was a reasonable conclusion that game wildlife has a place in this as well as game wildlife. And for the acquisition, that is a different constitutional standard.
If you think those belong in outdoor heritage? Did you ever talk about zoos belonging in outdoor heritage?
Madam Chair, I know your passion for zoos, but I think I can say that we never discussed zoos as part of outdoor heritage.
That's a
little
butter.
Wildlife. Representative Virginia.
Yes, I would ask our council if we could have a discussion later about the comment that Mr. Becker made for acquisition, you need to be able to shoot there. That is not the way I read the Constitution, and maybe I'm very wrong about this, so I would like to have our council help us out with that at a future date, if that would be okay.
Later, Mr. Yes. Representative, any others? Okay, everybody's gotten. Almost everyone has asked questions, and I put a couple out, but I didn't get all mine answered yet, so don't get excited about we're winding down, and then there is more to the agenda, too. I need to know what accomplishment plans mean. Is that outcome?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Becker.
Yes, it is outcome. And it's outcome with the timeline. So that you know how much of what is done and when it's done. And in addition to a final timeline, milestones along the way, that are significant milestones that can be used to ensure that the recipient of the funds is making progress.
And going back to the other question, then, I think it was Representative Hausman's question about the outdoor council will be the one that using the accomplishment plans and evaluating the accomplishment plan?
Madam Chair, I think that's true, but I think also the agent, DR, will be using them as well to manage the project. The major role for the council is to approve the content of the accomplishment plan and the accomplishments that are being offered.
So, if the council doesn't fulfill the accomplishment plan, then DNR will tell them to get on the stick, or will tell us that they're not meeting and shouldn't be refinanced.
In the case of a pass-through appropriation, Madam Chair, the Department of Natural Resources would instruct the final recipient to get on the In the case of an appropriation to the Department of Natural Resources, the council would have all power and what that the state agencies, the council would have to do the admonishment and ask for better performance.
Okay. And maybe not even an admonishment, just a prodding. Okay. Representative Hansen, let's go back to the appropriation, $695,000, and the money from the House File 18 and the makeup of, I think you mentioned something about staff. Would you go over that information again so I can hear it one more time so I know what it is that is being suggested that we buy?
If you will give me a moment,
I will.
Sure to find my correct page.
I think it's 10, 11.
Yes.
And then I don't know where it is on your notes.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, so the $695,000, and that number is arrived at, I'm going to go through the sub-amounts of that, but also looking at the 1% of administrative costs available that are in the language that authorized the council. So 1% of the appropriated dollars. You look at the 695. So in the law that was passed last session, it says up to 1% of the funds appropriated may be used for administrative costs to council.
And I the think game and fish law.
The game and fish bill that was voted on in the last hours of session that authorized the council.
You said 1%. So that goes for this year.
Well, that's
2009 or is that forever?
That is appropriations for the council ongoing. You would appropriate funds, thus you have the $695,000 proposal here in front of you on page 10 that would be the appropriation for the coming year. We had to deal with House File 18 dealing with this year because we hadn't appropriated funds for 2009 because we didn't know if the amendment was going to pass and we started expending dollars, so we had House File 18, and then you see the subsequent language that acknowledges that on page 11. And we may need to just, take the House File 18 language that has moved through committee to line up there. But I'm going to read through the exact sub-amounts. For administration of the council, three staff.
Pardon me?
Three staff. Space, equipment, and programming. Meetings. And then the loan repayment from the Game and Fish Fund that's currently being used relating to Mr. Becker's time and for reimbursement for the council members. The executive director, $130,000. And I should note, having been a state employee, that that is not a salary, that is associated costs that are involved. There is a calculation that goes when you have the salary for that benefits and associated costs related to that individual staff position. So that does not mean that Bill, is, in an acting capacity, is receiving $130,000 a year. So I want to make that clear, because when you put numbers out here, often people may assume that relating to state employment. Administrative assistant, $80,000. Program research analyst, $120,000. Public meeting facilitation contract, $60,000. Office rent, phones, computers, and systems, $50,000. Travel and meeting expenses, assume 20 meetings a year. I believe that's $80,000. And then $150,000 of the repayment of DNR for the loan, and then keeping a $25,000 reserve totals up to $695,000. And I can make a copy of my notes here for you and the committee if you'd like.
We would really appreciate it. And that is authorized by the Game and Fish laws of 2008.
Madam Chair, the law that established the council said that up to 1% may be used for administrative. Your responsibility in this committee and the legislature is to appropriate funds.
Up to 1%.
Up to 1%. And we can get you the exact statute. I don't know if we have it here. Mr. Becker could read the exact language, which my memory may be a little confused.
Up to.
Would you mind,
Madam Chair, would you like to have the statute read?
No, just give me the number again.
978.0567 subdivision 28.
And Dr. Kilgore, as you discussed all this, you decided that this was the correct number for your purposes?
Madam Chair,
for the future?
This budget was developed primarily by Bill Becker's staff.
Based on conversations or based on the statute, Mr. Becker?
The council discussed the overall the details that you've been providing today is information that I've passed on to the legislative coordinators for this commission that, as I understand it, has the control over the appropriation and would approve any budget for any council. So the budget, as I would understand it, has to go through the council, which has not yet been done. Then to the Legislative Coordinating Commission, and that's where it's going, as I understand the time.
Okay. Mr. Becker, have you been consulted by any of the people in any of the other funds about how you were setting up?
Madam Chair, have I been consulted?
Yes. Or not, you know, it's anybody called and said, "Hey, Bill, what are you doing over there?
Madam Chair,
how are you going to use your 1%?
Madam Chair, I've been consulted by committee staff. Madam Chair, we have talked with Mr. Givinger. And Madam Chair, I'm fairly familiar with the other resource council, our commission. that has a different process than the five that we expect.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to remember our discussion a few months ago, I guess it was, with Department of Administration and Grants Management, and I can't remember. I know that, you know, it's typical when you get a grant, you have to have an independent audit done before you close out, and I don't know if you're under LCC, if the legislative auditor does that, and would that come from the individual grant funds so that anyone applying would have to set some aside for that, or how do we pick up some of those kind of things?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler.
Representative Hansen.
I put on my auditor commission hat and say that any public funds, the legislative auditor has the authority to review and do audits of those funds.
And just to follow up, Representative Loeffler. So, Representative Hansen, are you saying we don't need to worry about in this fund or the other funds appropriating money for audits and how the money was used, or is that just that they have the authority to do it if they want to? Representative Hansen.
I'm Chair Representative Loeffler. They have the authority for financial audits. There's usually a schedule of auditing. For other types of audits, as the Chair knows, sometimes there's not the staff needs that for relating to certain, we may only be able to choose certain numbers of things for review or evaluation at some time. But that kind of depends on the staff and the level of interest relating to program audit evaluation. Financial audits, there is a schedule that goes over, but it is dependent. The legislative auditor is just like the LCCMR or this fund is that it's under the LCC. So when we have a state government appropriation, it's in the legislative branch, therefore it's subject to any cuts that occur to the legislative branch.
Sometimes, Representative Loeffler, people that you count on don't circle number six. Mr. Becker.
Madam Chair, to add, and I know Representative Hansen had to say, subdivision six of the previously mentioned statute, 978.056, requires the council to audit the project every 2 years. So I don't think that other things would be different than that. I don't think that just meaning that out of the up to 1%, an audit has to be financed every 2 years.
Okay. Okay, seeing no other questions at this time, the next item on the agenda is public testimony. Deborah Carasa.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. We will get back to
you. You may be recalled. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Chairperson Murphy. That's a hard act to follow. Members of the committee, I am truly honored and grateful for the opportunity as a member of the public to address this committee. My name is Deborah Karasov, and I am executive director of a nonprofit called Great River Greening. We do on-the-ground conservation work. We started in St. Paul. And I would like to say that behind me are 20,000 volunteers who over our years since 1995 have participated in our events. We also have professional ecologists that do restoration work. And the reason that they come and the reason that I'm here today on behalf of them is that they're very frustrated with the degraded woodlands, the diseased trees, the eroded trails, the forests that are choked by invasive species, and the sediment filled in our lakes and waters. I am very grateful for the work of the LaSalle Outdoor Heritage Council, and I cannot even imagine how I would have done such a good job of reviewing proposals in such a short time. However, I do believe that the package could benefit by having a little bit of tweaking. And in particular, the $69 million package has very little restoration projects in it. And this is very hard for me to say because I partner a lot with many of the acquisition and easement partners that are in the proposal currently. And I respect their work. But I do feel that restoration at this time in our state economic situation, restoration creates or retains jobs of site contractors, nurseries, engineering firms, and field technicians. And in our case, in addition to supporting those jobs, we also have a youth program for seasonal field crew targeted at at-risk youth. And I know there are many businesses who would love to have even a third of the outdoor heritage money going to restoration instead of acquisition and easement. While there are indeed 25 years of heritage funding, public and private landowners are suffering now massive funding squeezes, and restoration costs rise exponentially with every year, in some cases making it out of reach. And we have known this many years because all of the public and private landowners come to Great River Greening. We are the only nonprofit whose sole core competency is natural resource management. And I would suggest we would lose the very habitat quality for which we purchase land if we don't manage it. And there are many, many backups of land and acres that are requiring natural resource management before we even start buying new ones. Now, it's true, Great River Greening had a proposal before the LaSalle Council, and I hope that many of my 20,000 volunteers or board members or any of my supporters would contact you about that proposal, and I don't want to, it's not appropriate for me to propose it. But I would like to suggest one thing, is that it was a restoration project, and it was in a region, the Anoka Sand Plain, which was virtually ignored by the Star Council. And the significant thing about the Anoka Sand Plain ecological region is that it is where you find oak savanna, which is a globally endangered plant community. 2 million acres used to occur in the state of Minnesota. We now have 3,800 acres. The historic range of some 30 species of great need are found here, including 9 birds whose habitat nationwide has been vanishing for decades, highlighted by a nationwide Department of Interior survey. So ours is only one project of many restoration projects, and I would just encourage you to consider the many people, including the people I represent, who want good, high-quality, healthy forest savannas, prairies, and are looking towards the legacy money to do this kind of management. Thank you very much.
Questions? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else that came to see with the hopes of being able to say anything? Yes, please identify yourself.
Madam Chair, I'm Dave Shad. I'm the Fish and Wildlife Director for the Department of Natural Resources. Just wanted to make a brief statement here. Commissioner Holston was here earlier, but had to attend to some other business. But on behalf of the Natural Resources Department of Natural Resources, just wanted to let this committee know that we have great respect for the work that the LaSalle Outdoor Heritage Council did here in a very short period of time. They really did a very good job of developing, I thought, a very, very good process to
accept proposals, develop their recommendations. Our staff were very, very involved in presenting information on some of our programs, some of the existing plans that we have in place, some of the very successful delivery mechanisms for getting conservation on the ground here in the state. Our staff were also very involved in developing recommendations, working with the many partners out there to develop very good, very sound proposals that were that could be delivered quickly and in the right places and in the right ways. And then moving forward, we certainly pledge to do whatever we can to make sure that the dollars that will be appropriated to the agency and then granted to these various entities to do this work, to do our due diligence to make sure that those dollars are spent appropriately and in keeping with the council and the legislature's direction. You'll also note in Subdivision 5 that that the bill does direct the Conservation Partners Grants Program to be administered by the Department of Natural Resources. This differs from the council's original recommendation that the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation would oversee that program. If it's the legislature's wish that the department administer this grants program, this small grants program, we'll certainly do that and we'll do a good job of it. We've had our grant staff taking a look at this for some time on how we would do this to ensure that it's a good and viable program. And we'll certainly do our best to deliver it. I would point out, though, that the council did a very good job of soliciting proposals from the various groups and agencies and organizations to administer this program. They looked at costs, they looked at experience in running similar programs, issues related to conflict of interest and so forth. And we thought they made a very good and sound decision that we supported in recommending that that program to the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. But again, if it's the legislature's wish that the department administer that program, we'll certainly do a good job of it.
Okay. Questions? Thank you, Mr. Schott.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else? Representative Kahn.
I actually came here for another purpose and suddenly saw this going on. This change was made in my division, so perhaps if you want me to speak to the reason why we made it, is that appropriate at this time or do you not?
I'll
get a couple of sentences.
Sure.
We just thought that this is a lot of public money. We thought it was much more appropriate to be administered by a public agency. We also think, in terms of one of the things that we specifically heard about the legacy fund, is that it's one of the important things we ought to think of at all times is the creation of jobs in Minnesota. Now, we're not talking about a lot of jobs, but when we're talking about DNR administrative expenses, we're, you know, that still means of the jobs in Minnesota. And we just thought that it was much more appropriate to have it administered. And we also, in terms of the numbers, and we've gone back and forth on administrative expenses, LCCMR says that they have a maximum of 4% administrative expenses, but they've never gone over 2.2. And one person from DNR administration, Denise Anderson, is that the name of the person? Yes, Denise Anderson, told us that DNR has a 2.5% cost of administration of grants, plus the fact that one of the things we've done in my committee on grants administration now is the ability to charge a small fee on the grant to administer it, which is another cost. So we were looking at 2.5% as opposed to the 700,000 was looked at 100 or 4 million. You were looking at 100,000 rather than 700,000 in administrative expenses. So even if those numbers have to be a little closer, there's still a huge difference between them. So,
and Representative Kahn, did you, in your committee then, too, did you talk about
the LCC and the staffing of the, you know, the council under the 59, under the game and fish law of 2008, yeah, on page 10, under the Legislative Coordinating Committee, and that $695,000.
That's actually different, because that's not, I'm only dealing.
Okay, you only dealt with that one part.
Yes.
Okay.
So, you know, we just assume that this number was right and that this was what it was. This is the expenses of the council itself for the council to do traveling and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And we didn't have any, we saw no reason to question the amount that had come in for that. This was this administration of the $4 million grant program we thought was a huge administrative expense, you know, just compared to the numbers that we're used to seeing.
And I just heard Mr. Shad say that they will be able to administer it just fine.
Okay. I guess I came in with the right
Didn't I hear you say that, Mr. Shad?
No, at the end.
And you're willing?
Madam Chair.
And would be able to administer this just fine, I heard.
Madam Chair, we'll certainly do our best to administer this program. However, our estimate of the cost to administer this program is closer to 7% rather than 2%. And that's, again, based on our grants folks taking a look at the complexities of this, potential complexities of this grants program. This is a large and new program. We expect that we'll be granting these dollars in many cases, small conservation organizations that don't have paid staff that are going to need a lot of hand-holding developing proposals and in getting that money on the ground and complying with all the grant requirements. Obviously, more and smaller grants increase the cost of administration of this program, and we really do believe that the 7%, which would in essence fund two full-time grants managers and an administrative assistant, would be needed to fund a program of size of a $4 million annual program going forward.
Thank you, Mr. Schaff. I guess I should check my hearing a little bit. But, Mr. Schaff, this committee from the beginning, since the first day we started talking about grants and grant giving, has heard about the grant program at DNR, and that Mr. Sam is just a wonderful grants manager. And we've heard that in conversations, and we've heard it in testimony. So our level of trust is high.
And Madam Chair, he is a wonderful fella, and he's been very involved in pulling together these cost estimates, our administrative cost estimates for this program.
Representative Virginia.
Madam Chair, I need to tell you that my committee has sent your committee a bill with grant proposals in it, and this is in the park. And Representative Lilly's bill, it's a $9 million or $9.1 million. I have to stop and think about that. But anyway, at least a $9 million grants program. And when I asked DNR about that, they said, "Oh yes, we need a percentage." And I put the percentage in the bill that they asked for, and it was 2.5%. And nobody said a word to me about it.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I think there's a fundamental difference in some of these grants programs that needs to be recognized when you're looking at the administrative burden that it places on the agency, and in most cases the grants program that Representative Ledini is referencing are grants to other government entities, city or county or governments, that sort of thing, and they're typically larger grants as well. Again, the concern that we've got with this program is it may be to government entities, but in many cases it's going to be to, and I think the intent was to provide a place for conservation organizations, sportsmen's clubs, and other entities to come and fund smaller projects. And with that comes a greater burden as far as administration.
Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, again, we have a whole, in the state government finance bill, there's a whole grants management section in the Department of Administration. And one of the principles that we've done in that, and it's interesting because we originally had a must, they asked us for May, and then they didn't do it, so we've gone back to a must again, 3 years of dealing with this. But what we said is that the cost of administering a grant shall be taken as a fraction of that grant, so that you don't, and this is principle from the old years when I used to be an academic in the University of Minnesota, hit the National Science Foundation, National Institute of Health for overhead in terms of what the grants management are. And that ought to be, and there's no reason why that shouldn't be a basic principle of doing it. It could be a small percentage, you can negotiate it with the person that gets the grant, but there's no reason to have a separate cost that then goes on top of the grant. And I thought, maybe it's in the statute, I thought we had limitations, or maybe it's just that we've talked about, limitations on the percentage spent for administration of the legacy fund. And I don't, again, I'm not sure, I don't know if it's not in the Constitution, I actually thought it was even in there. And the point is, you've got to count, you can't take this $4 million off the cap and say that, and not count the administrative expenses that are part of this $4 million. And so if that's more than, so for any chunk of it, you want to be real careful that that's not over 1%. And they're just going to have to, you know, and I don't know about the decision that made to give it to these small organizations that we're now told are going to be incompetent to manage the money. But I think it's got to come either off the amount, a percentage off the amount of grants. And I just have faith that they're going to be okay. These are people with a lot of goodwill. There's a lot of volunteer stuff that's going into it. And I don't think they're going to need the degree of hand-holding that's being predicted. You know, I think you're going to need a serious oversight, but you know, I think we'll give them enough money to do that. So.
Okay. Looks like somebody else wants to begin.
Thank you. Madam Chair, since you're discussing my employer, I thought I'd like to talk to you a little bit. My name is Don Waggy, and I'm the regional director for the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. And since many of you probably haven't heard of us before, I thought I should just tell you a little bit about us. We're an organization that was established by the United States Congress 25 years ago. What our mission is to help governmental entities, state, federal, whatever, accomplish their mission. The natural resource agencies of government accomplish their mission. And what we do is we basically manage grant programs for governmental entities. Basically all the natural resource organizations in the United States government, and right now we're managing about 20 different grant programs for 11 different states. The states include California, Colorado, Idaho, Montana, New Mexico, New York, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Utah, Washington, and Wyoming. So this is kind of unusual for Minnesota, but it's not unusual nationally. In Minnesota, we've had a presence here, we've had our regional office here for 10 years, and we've made over our history 242 grants in the state of Minnesota to 118 organizations. I think just about every single one that's on this list of the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council, and of course many, many more. And we've made a total of $31.6 million in grants. We think we're a very highly efficient organization, and we think we're effective.
and maybe I can answer any questions you might have about our organization.
I think maybe the person that might have is gone. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Kevin Lyons. I'm the Conservation Easement Manager for the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and I would just like to provide some testimony and comments related to the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council's good work and challenging job in looking at all the great projects that were submitted and brought forward. Specifically on page 6 of the bill is the Reinvest the Minnesota Wetland Reserve Program Partnership. I want to just highlight quickly how critically important this project is. Last year, through bond funds that we received for the partnership, we were able to secure 20% of the nation's WRP funds for Minnesota for wetland restoration and conservation easements across Minnesota's across the state of Minnesota. Particularly this program, we partner for every dollar of state funds that we receive, we're able to leverage $1.4 of federal funds. Federal WRP funds for our wetland restoration efforts in Minnesota, and as I alluded to, last year we were able to secure 20% of the nation's WRP funds for Minnesota. The council's recommendation at $9 million will allow us to look at the balance funds that we still have remaining from the 2008 bond funds, but will allow us to again fully leverage the 2009 federal fiscal year through the federal government, which ends September 30th, 2009. So we're going to be able to leverage approximately an additional $16.5 million of federal WRP funds for Minnesota with this council's recommendation. So I'd just like to thank the council's recommendation, and hopefully the your committee also sees that this is a great opportunity for continuing that wetland restoration activity.
And Mr. Lyons, who do you think is going to do the work?
Well, the particular RIM WRP partnership, we primarily deliver the program through both local NRCS staff, federal staff, as well as local soil and water conservation districts, as well as we have other conservation partners through Ducks Unlimited, Minnesota Waterfall Association that work locally at the county soil and water conservation district office level to go out and market and public relations to the volunteer landowners that come in and are interested in looking at wetland restoration activities on their land. So there's various roles from acquiring and the acquiring easements and title work and all the activities associated with that. But we also have economic studies that USDA have done regarding their WRP program that for every $33 million of this partnership activity, it creates or maintains 527 jobs across Minnesota and related to this partnership. And that can be from contractors that are hired to construct the wetlands, do the concrete work, native grass seedings, associated restoration activities associated with that. So it's very much locally delivered, and you know, by two landowners that have, of course, been ranked and scored. We have a lot of competition for the program. As much opportunity as we've had last year, of that, we were only able to fund 98 out of 265 requests from landowners. So there's a lot of demand for wetland restoration activity, but this is a great opportunity to leverage federal funds, in this case through the WRP program, which receives annual appropriations from Congress through the federal farm bill. So we know for a fact WRP will have roughly for Minnesota $16.5 million for the next 5 years, and we're needing to look at ways that we can leverage state funds to ensure this wetland restoration activity can be accelerated and continued.
Thank you very much. Any other agency people here that want to enlighten us about anything that came up? Any other questions? If not, watch your emails for the next meeting. This meeting is adjourned.